This is Audible.
Chop Wood, Carry Water: How to Fall in Love with the Process of Becoming Great, by Joshua Medcalf. Read by the author. Chapter 1. For as long as his family could remember, John and his younger brother Jordan had been in love with the samurai culture of Japan. When John was only 8 years old, his family visited many places in Asia. He and Jordan excitedly explored every place they visited and dreamt of returning one day to become their favorite type of samurai warriors, archers. A year later, tragedy struck as the family was in a bad car accident and Jordan was severely injured. The rest of the family was pretty banged up, but Jordan was barely hanging on to life in the ICU. For the first few months, John sat at his bedside, only leaving the hospital to shower 2 times a week. Reading him stories throughout the day of the samurai culture that they both loved so much. Every night they would fall asleep to Jackie Chan movies. John's parents even let him miss the first few months of school. Eventually, after 5 months of being in the hospital, Jordan was cleared to go home. The doctor said he would never be able to talk, walk, or feed himself. Jordan still found ways to communicate and play with John, and they became even more close than they were before the accident. John always admired his brother's positive attitude, despite his circumstances. The doctor said for Jordan to go through a normal day, it required as much energy as it does for an average person to run a marathon. As John entered his teenage years, he never forgot their shared love for the samurai. And over time, his fascination turned to deep admiration and lasting respect. He began to think more and more about pursuing it in his future. Finally, when he turned 18, John bought a one-way ticket to an ancient city in Japan, intent on fulfilling his boyhood dream. He enrolled as an apprentice to a small community of samurai who lived outside the city walls, practicing their timeless traditions. There, he knew he could become a samurai archer. When John arrived, he was greeted by a friendly old sensei named Akira. He helped John unload his bags and get settled. As they walked the grounds, taking a look at the advanced training areas and shooting ranges, John grew more and more excited. This place is amazing! He couldn't wait to get started. But the next morning, Akira gathered the newly arrived apprentices and informed them of their first task. For the rest of the morning, they must chop wood and carry water. John was surprised and confused. He addressed his teacher with the proper title of respect they had been taught. Akira sensei, what do you mean? The old man explained that their community was outfitted with every modern convenience, except for heat and running water. Instead of using gas or electricity, they burned wood for heat when the weather grew cold, and in order to use water in the bathrooms and kitchen, it must be brought by hand from a well outside. Thus, in order for the community to use water and stay warm during the winter, the community depended on everyone to chop wood and carry water. But when will we get to shoot? John wondered out loud. Akira just smiled. Shooting will come soon enough, but first, you must learn to chop wood and carry water. John was frustrated, but he obeyed. He trusted his sensei's wisdom and knew that in time, they would move on to more exciting things. Chapter 2. The next day was hot and muggy. John sweated as he drove his axe through log after log. His shoulders ached as he hauled bucket after bucket of water from the well into the house, and his hands began to blister from the friction of the axe handle. It was frustrating watching men old enough to be in retirement homes chop wood and carry water so effortlessly. But he kept working, remembering Akira's words, that shooting will come soon enough. Finally, after the day's work had finished, Akira took John aside. He handed him a cup of cool water and told him a story. He told John that in Japan they had a deep love of architecture, and there was once a man named Koda who built some of the finest houses in all of Tokyo. His work became world famous due to his dedication to the process, his willingness to beat on his craft, and his relentless devotion to keep learning even late into his career. Eventually, though, Koda grew tired of building homes for other people, and he was ready to retire. He had been building homes for over 30 years, and he was ready to move on. He wanted to travel and spend lots of time with his grandkids. One day, Koda approached his boss and turned in his 2-week notice. His boss said, "Coda, we are forever indebted to you for the magnificent work you have done for our company, and we are so grateful you have worked for us for so long. We do have one favor to ask of you, though. Could you please build one more house? It is a very important house for a very important client, and everyone in the company agreed it needs your special touch." Coda was frustrated. He would have to cancel 2 trips and postpone his new life, all for one house? He told his boss that he needed a day to think about it. After talking it over with his wife, he gave in and decided he would build one more house. But he told his boss, "This is the very last one." But while Coda had agreed with his head to build this last house, his heart was no longer in it. He had always been very hands-on through the entire building process, always selecting the finest materials by hand and making sure every detail was diligently tended to. But this house, it was different. He viewed it more as an obligation than an opportunity. He delegated much of the work, and consequently a lot of things started slipping through the cracks. The house would be up to code, but as it started to come together, it was obvious that it lacked the wow factor that Coda's other homes were known for. Coda knew in his heart that this was far from his best work, but he was over it and ready to move on to the next phase of his life. The next phase was much more appealing and important to him than the present moment. After 4 months had passed, Coda finally finished the house. He went back to his boss, telling him, "I did what you asked. Now I'm asking one last time for your blessing to retire." His boss said, "Thank you, Coda. We just have one more thing." Now Coda was beginning to really get upset because he thought that they were going to ask him to build another house. His boss reached into his desk and pulled out a very small black box with a red ribbon tied around it. He handed the box to Coda and said, "We are so grateful for you. This gift is a token of our appreciation." Coda pulled the ribbon, opening the box to discover a set of shiny new keys. His boss smiled, "The house is yours. You deserve it." Immediately, his heart sank. Unbeknownst to Coda, the whole time he had been building his own house. If he had only known the house was his own, he would have cared so much more. He would have only used the finest materials, and he would have overseen every detail and given it his all like he had always done. But now, it was too late. Akira looked at John and said, "The only thing that is truly significant about today, or any other day, is who you become in the process. Think about it, John. What good is it to reach the top if you skip steps to get there? Would you want the person flying your plane, performing your surgery, or handling your money to have cheated?" Each of us are building our own house. Sometimes you might think you are building for your school, your family, your company, or your team, but you are always building your own house. I hope you build wisely. The story hit home for John, and he really started to think deeply about his own life. He sat in contemplation while wondering if he had been building his house wisely. Chapter 3. The next day, the sun rose, and so did John, with a burst of energy. He couldn't wait to get started on his real training. He rushed through the hours of chopping wood and carrying water, then raced to the archery range, excited to begin. But instead, Akira announced that they would focus simply on the basics of their stance and drawing motion without knocking a single arrow. John couldn't keep the disappointment from his voice. "Akira sensei, I thought you said we'd be shooting soon." The old man shook his head. "I said that shooting would come soon enough. First, you must learn how to stand." John swallowed his pride and obeyed, lining up with the other apprentices. Still, he couldn't help but think, "Learn how to stand? I know how to stand. What could I possibly not know about standing?" As it turned out, quite a bit. Akira gently and persistently adjusted John's every tiny motion, using a thin bamboo rod to nudge an elbow or prod a knee into place. Yet none of those adjustments were more than an inch, which surprised John greatly. "Are you sure this matters? It's just an inch." "But it is so much more than that." Akira handed John an arrow. "Draw and release." John obeyed, sending the arrow sailing, thwack, into the straw target. "Now draw again and hold." John obeyed, locking his form at full draw. Using the rod, Akira subtly adjusted John's elbow less than even an inch and stepped back. Release. John obeyed, but whoosh! The arrow sailed wide, barely grazing the target as it disappeared into the forest beyond. John couldn't believe his eyes. Akira smiled. Now you see how much an inch is worth. Every adjustment at the firing line means the difference between hitting the target or missing it. And the same is true in life. Every little thing we do, no matter how mundane, matters greatly when it is multiplied by the number of times we do it. Over time, even the smallest habit or choice can change the trajectory of our lives. Do you know what separates most wildly successful people from everyone else, John? Luck? Akira shook his head. No. Hard work? Again, no. Coming from the right background? Akira just smiled. Inches, John. That's all that separates them. John nodded his head, but still had trouble grasping it. Could that really be true? Sensing his hesitation, Akira continued. Think about your group of friends from high school. You're all from the same area. You're all the same age, and most of you had very similar sets of opportunities. And right now, someone might look at all of you and be unable to really see much of a difference. But in 10 years, the differences in your lives will be night and day. Someone you might have thought was an underachiever might be incredibly successful, while another who flourished in high school may be struggling to even survive. But I can assure you, the differences in their lives will always come down to inches. Most people are so consumed with their day-to-day lives that they never pause to see the big picture. And in the big picture, every single choice matters, no matter how small. Everything you choose to read, listen to, or look at, everything you think about, dream about, or focus on, and especially your circle, the people you surround yourself with and allow to influence you, can make up all the difference in who you become. Inches might look small up close, but added up over the right amount of time, they can cover any distance in the universe. John nodded, beginning to understand. I guess I never thought of that. The most amazing thing is, John, that all of those choices are very easy to make. It's not difficult to read 10 pages of a great book each day, or take a walk for 20 minutes each day to stay healthy, or to call your parents or a friend every week to maintain a relationship. But it's also just as easy not to do those things. For example, think about eating. Every day around the world, millions of people choose to consume fatty, sugary foods that over time will clog their arteries and kill them. This is no secret to anyone, and yet it happens every day. Why is that? John shrugged, blank, as Akira continued, because those foods won't kill them today. Today, it's just a hamburger or a hot dog or a soda. It doesn't seem like much. And of course, eating something like that once in a while isn't terrible. But in the long run, if you choose to eat it every day, that choice, that inch, can be the difference between life and death. You will make many choices during your time here training, John. They might not look like much at first. But I promise you that over the next 10 years, they will add up and make all the difference in whether or not you fulfill your true potential and live your dreams. I'll share with you one of the greatest pieces of wisdom for your journey. Greatness isn't for the chosen few. Greatness is for the few who choose. Chapter 4. As the weeks passed, John grew more comfortable with life in the community. As his form straightened and improved, he was allowed to begin working with arrows. Even though he and the other apprentices were limited to shooting only at practice targets, straw rolls only 7 feet away. But still, he persisted, trying to focus on everything each sensei taught him. One day, as he drew his bow, ready to release the arrow, snap! The bowstring split, leaving John with an unstrung bow. He quickly unpacked a new one from the apprentice's bowstring roll. Akira approached, watching with interest as John unraveled the new bowstring, trying to make sense of it. He slowly raised an eyebrow. John, have you done this before? John shook his head, but he wasn't worried. Not personally, but I've seen it done. So you know how to restring it? John beamed with confidence. Of course! I've read about it dozens of times, and like I said, I've seen it too. I've watched a lot of videos on YouTube. Calmly, Akira nodded. Good. Then I won't stop you. Concentrating hard, John slipped the top loop of the new bowstring snugly over the top end of his bow. Then he knelt, gently bending the bow toward him as he guided the bottom loop toward the bow's bottom end. But as he tried to slip the knot, the bowstring snapped. He couldn't get it to fit. It kept sliding all over the place, made it even more difficult by the slick resin coated on the brand new bowstring. John tried a few more times, getting more and more frustrated each one. Akira just watched in silence, until finally John exclaimed in pure frustration, "What the heck is wrong with this thing? Why can't I get it to work?" Akira replied calmly, "Because, John, you only have Genosko of it." John thought he had just heard that wrong. "What?" Akira grinned. "If that sounded like Greek to you, that's because it is. Genosko is a Greek word that means to have knowledge of something, as opposed to yada, which means knowledge gained through experience with something. The two are very different." John nodded to his still unstrung bow. "I'll say they are." "Who would you want to go into battle with, John? Someone who has studied and read about war for 25 years, or someone who has trained and experienced the front lines of battle?" "Well, when you put it that way, I want the person who has the real experience in battle," said John. An ancient warrior once said, "It's one thing to study war, another to live the warrior's life." In a world where anyone can look up information online, it's deceptively easy to gain knowledge. You can get pretty confident by reading everything you can get your hands on about a certain subject. It's called artificial maturity. But knowing about how to do something and having practical experience actually doing that something are radically different. John sighed. "I guess I've got a long way to go." Akira smiled, handing John a pouch of fine granulated powder. "You might want to start with this." The powder gives the bowstring some grip and stops it from slipping off the wood. Excited, John coated the string with the powder, and as Akira guided him, finally slipped it over the wood, restringing the bow. With a grin, he leapt back to the firing line and began to practice again, thankful for such a kind and patient mentor. Chapter 5. As the weeks passed, John grew more comfortable with the life in the community. One day, he woke up to find all the other apprentices crowded excitedly around an announcement that had been posted in the dining hall. It announced that each year, the incoming class of apprentices would be able to compete in an archery tournament. John could barely contain his excitement. He loved competition and was intent on winning the tournament. He couldn't stop talking about it that morning as he finished his daily routine. Finally, Akira grabbed his shoulders and sat him down. He looked deep into John's eyes. "John, Mother Teresa always told people, be faithful in the small things, for it is in them that your strength lies. The temptation while you are here with us will be to focus on all the big, sexy goals, like winning the tournament and becoming a great samurai archer. You must fight that temptation and stay focused on chopping wood and carrying water. Do you recognize the name Ingvar Kamprad?" John shook his head. "No." "Good," Akira smiled wide. "Ingvar was a boy who spent 4 or 5 years selling individual matchsticks door-to-door in his small town in Sweden. He was often laughed at when he would tell the other boys he couldn't play, because he needed to ride his bike 3 hours into Stockholm to purchase another box of matches." John couldn't believe his ears. "Hold on, you mean to tell me that this little kid was really selling individual matchsticks door-to-door for years?" "Yes, John, this is a true story. When Ingvar was 17 years old, he decided to name his company. You might have heard of it. IKEA is worth over $150 billion today." John listened in awe as Akira continued. "John, everyone wants to start the next IKEA, but few are willing to be faithful selling individual matchsticks door to door. Everyone wants to build the next Apple or Facebook. Nobody wants to sell matches. Everyone wants to become a samurai warrior, but few are willing to faithfully chop wood, carry water. Every now and then a person comes along and accidentally gets it right the first time, but most of us have to learn the hard way through multiple failed experiments, which allows us to learn lessons and skills those who had it easier never develop. Steve Jobs didn't set out to transform entertainment, computers, music, telecommunications, and education. It happened as a byproduct of passion, persistence, and faithfulness to a small idea. The problem with small is that it isn't sexy, and it's often boring. A guy who played professional golf was once hit by a bus, and the people serving as his doctors told him he would never walk again. But he trained hard day in and day out, and went on to win a major. He said, Everyone thinks greatness is sexy. It's not. It's dirty, hard work. Ingvar didn't have a sexy idea. He had an idea most people would laugh at today. I can't even imagine how much grief he took from friends and family. You're doing what? That's the stupidest idea ever. Everybody wants to win championships, but nobody wants to sweep the barn they practice in, like John Wooden did for his first few years at UCLA. Everyone wants to be great until it's time to do what greatness requires. Don't believe the myths. Greatness is far from sexy. It is dirty, hard work. Usually required to be done in the dark, when no one is watching, while your dreams are so far off, they feel like fairy tales. Dream big. Start small. Be ridiculously faithful. Focus on what you can control. Your greatest challenge during your time here will be your faithfulness to keeping your focus on the process while surrendering the outcome. John nodded his head in acknowledgement, but the truth was more than he could handle. He thought he understood, but some things can only be experienced to be fully learned. Chapter 6. After the excitement of the first few months had started to wear off, John began to get frustrated. The monotony of chopping wood and carrying water every morning and every evening had begun to wear on him. He was only allowed to practice archery for 4 hours during the heat of the day. What frustrated him the most was that he was only allowed to shoot at a straw roll that was only 7 feet away from him. He and the other apprentices were also required to attend weekly workshops where they learned life skills and lessons through stories. One day he approached Akira and asked, "Akira-sensei, how long will it take me to become a samurai archer? I've dreamed my whole life of becoming one, but it feels like it will take forever." Akira stopped what he was doing and said, "In the West, you want everything instantly, but here you must learn to fall in love with the process of becoming great. Now go, chop wood and carry water." John was confused, but he went back to his normal daily activities. The months passed, and before he knew it, an entire year had gone by. During the first year's acclimation period, apprentices are not allowed to speak with their family and friends, but John was finally able to have a Skype video call with his family. He was disappointed to share with them that he hadn't moved past shooting at a target only 7 feet away from him, and that the rest of his time each day was just spent chopping wood and carrying water. As John talked about his daily routine, his father got a big smile on his face. He asked John who his favorite basketball players were growing up. John replied, "That's easy, Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan." His dad then told him how Phil Jackson had just released a book, 11 Rings, and how he was constantly telling the guys on his teams about the necessity of chop wood, carry water. No matter whether you are winning or losing, the point was to focus on the process and neither get too high or too low, but instead to control the controllables. After the call, John's spirits were much better. It was especially hard being away from Jordan, and just seeing him was so encouraging to John. A few months went by, and as John practiced, his muscles began to learn the familiar motions of drawing and releasing, and his shots grew more and more accurate. He began to feel very confident with his bow and hitting the 7-foot target. One day, while he was practicing, Akira walked over and John asked again, "Akira-sensei, I'm getting better and better each week. How long will it take for me to become a samurai archer now?" Akira smiled and told him it would take 10 years. John was furious. 10 years? Maybe if I didn't have to spend so much time chopping wood and carrying water, then I would be able to reach my goal much faster. Akira replied, "If you don't chop wood and carry water, then it will take you 20 years to become a samurai archer." Then he turned and walked away. John was even more confused, and he questioned whether or not he should quit. Would it really take him 10 years? He wasn't sure this investment was worth it, but he decided he would try even harder. More time passed, and John's shots became more accurate and more powerful. He came to love the sound of the arrow slamming into the target. Thwack! Thwack! Soon, he was certain that he would become a samurai archer in less than 10 years. So one day, as they were carrying water back from the well, he pulled Akira aside and said, "Akira-sensei, I am more accurate now, and my shots are more powerful than ever. How long will it take me to become a samurai archer?" Akira smiled. "You know the answer. It is still 10 years. John kept pressing, "But what if I devote every waking moment to becoming a samurai archer? No chopping wood or carrying water, just archery." But Akira only shrugged. "Then it will take 30 years. John had reached his emotional breaking point. He blurted out, "But I don't understand." Akira looked at John with compassion. "You will learn, young John. The reason it takes longer is because with one eye on the goal, you only have one eye for the journey." He then went on to tell John stories of people who climb ice mountains and how if they are focused on the top of the mountain, they will not know where to step in front of them. They will slip and die. The key to ice climbing is to focus on one solid step at a time. No man climbs a mountain all at once. He climbs it by making one solid step at a time. John nodded. He understood now. He would try and focus on doing his best at archery, chopping wood, carrying water, and surrendering the results. Chapter 7. But try as he might, John kept unconsciously slipping back into his old habits. Growing up, he had always succeeded in sports and school by focusing on proving himself. Some of his coaches even told him they liked the way he played with a chip on his shoulder, and even in the peaceful environment of the samurai community, it was hard for him to shake those instincts of seeing life as one test after another to prove his worth. Without realizing it, he began to pride himself on completing each drill and archery movement the fastest, and even made sure that he chopped more wood and carried more water in less time than the other apprentices. One day, he was so focused on this that he filled his buckets well above the normal level. Walking briskly toward the community house, his foot caught the lip of an old root buried in the ground, and the weight of the water in his bucket sent him toppling over. He slammed to the ground, soaked to the bone. But just as he opened his mouth to shout in anger, he noticed Akira watching. The old sensei had seen the whole thing, and as John picked himself painfully up off the ground, Akira pulled John to his feet, picked up one of his buckets, and walked with him back toward the well. "You were carrying quite a lot of water, weren't you?" he asked. John shrugged, trying to play it off. "I guess. I don't really think about it. I just try to carry the most I can." Akira saw through this, asking quietly, "The most you can? Or just more than any of the others?" John reddened, caught, as Akira went on, "John, you keep getting in the way of your own potential because you keep seeing everything as a test. The secret is to understand that nothing is a test, but only an opportunity to learn and grow. Many people never fulfill their potential because they look at every situation in life as a test. If you look at something as a test, then you will focus only on passing the test instead of maximizing your growth through the experience. Over time, the person who is simply focused on maximizing what they can learn and grow will become much greater than the person who sees life as one continual test to prove themselves." John nodded, struggling with that wisdom. "Don't fall for the trap, John. Even tests in school are not tests. Nothing is a test. It's only an illusion. Everything is an opportunity to learn and grow. Because remember, you are building your own house." Chapter 8. As time passed, despite Akira's warnings, John grew more and more intently focused on his goal of becoming a samurai archer. He even began to sneak in extra time at the range. Every night at dusk, he would slip away from the dining hall and down to the range, where he'd shoot until darkness fell. But over time, the extra practice began to wear on his body. Then one afternoon at the range, he began to feel a burning tightness as he drew his bow, which became increasingly painful as he locked his shoulder into the firing position. He pushed through it, forcing his body to repeat the motion. But soon the pain in his shoulder made firing his bow impossible. He cringed as, "What's wrong, John?" Akira walked toward him. Clearly, the old sensei had noticed the pain in John's eyes. John knew there was no way to hide it. The next thing he knew, he was in the infirmary, getting his shoulder wrapped. Akira explained his injury, telling him, "Practice is good, but too much practice is not. Your muscles have torn, and they need time to rest in order to heal." "How long?" 6 to 8 weeks. John's face fell as he realized that because of this, he would fall far behind in his program. Seeing this, Akira asked him a question. "John, who would you be if everything you do was taken away from you?"
"What do you mean, Akira-sensei?"
"I mean that right now, you are not an archer. You can't even shoot. So who are you?" John thought for a minute, becoming frustrated as he realized he didn't have a good answer. Akira nodded, understanding. "Do not worry. Even I fall into this trap, John. It's so easy for me to get caught up in the results I get from working with people, to get lost in the work or in the response from my archers. I constantly have to remind myself that my value comes from who I am,
not from what I do. It's easy to feel like your value is much greater when your teams win, when you make a lot of money, when you experience great success in business, but it's just as easy to feel defeated and depressed when your teams aren't winning, when your business is failing, and when it feels like you are failing at everything. The truth is that your value is constant. It's infinitely priceless, and it never goes up or down based off of results of your performance. Your value comes from who you are, not from what you do. Every human being is infinitely priceless. You are more than an athlete. You are more than a parent or a brother or a daughter. You are more than a coach. You are more than a CEO. You are more than a fast food worker. When your identity gets wrapped up in what you do, it clouds every decision you make. It is easy to see some of the reasons that a person would make very compromising decisions when their identity comes from what they do. You must fight that instinct. John nodded, realizing the truth in his sensei's words. Akira stood to go, leaving John with this. Here is my challenge for you during your time here, John. Find your identity in something that cannot simply be stripped away in a moment, but instead do the hard work of reminding yourself that your value comes from who you are. For me, it took a long time to grasp this, but my identity comes from being a child of God and that He recklessly and unconditionally loves me. I believe He feels the same way about you and already unconditionally loves you. It has never been about your performance, and it will never be about your performance. You can't do anything to make Him love you any more, and you can't do anything to make Him love you any less. Therefore, you are free to accept His love, love Him back, love yourself, and finally be freed to love others with no strings attached. I do not expect you to believe everything that I believe, John. You must come to your own conclusions. Whatever you do, though, please don't find your identity in something that can be gone in an instant. Chapter 9. One of the hardest things for John to grow accustomed to in his new life was the fact that he must train every day, no matter how cold or wet. The only thing that stopped their training was lightning. He had grown up amidst sunshine and warmth, so adjusting to the biting chill of a winter wind or the gusting rain of the summer monsoon season was difficult for him. One day in particular, as the bright colors of autumn began to fade from the trees, an ice-cold wind swept through, so piercing that it seemed to go right through his clothes and into his bones. As John shot arrow after arrow, he couldn't stop shivering. In fact, he was shivering so badly that it began to affect his aim. He struggled again and again, but couldn't seem to find a rhythm in his shots. Akira noticed, walking over. "What's going on, John? I couldn't help but notice you seem to be having some trouble." John nodded, fighting to keep his teeth from chattering. "I feel like I'm going to freeze to death." But instead of acknowledging the cold, Akira simply replied, "Let me ask you a question. Where would you rather be uncomfortable? Here in training or under the bright lights?" John thought hard about it. "Here, I guess." "That's right. Uncomfortable isn't a choice, but where you experience it is. Life will always be difficult somewhere. But we can choose to experience that difficulty now or push it off until later. Everything costs something. Nothing comes free. Hard isn't a choice, but where you experience it is. Some people say, it's too hard. Guess what? So is being broke. So is failing to come close to your potential. So is the pain of regret." Akira just shook his head, obviously frustrated with people who had failed to heed his warnings in the past. "Do you know who the Navy SEALs are, John?" John's eyes lit up at the mention of the most elite group of warriors in the modern world. "Of course, they're the toughest soldiers on the planet. Do you know why? Because their training is the toughest on the planet. Week after week of nonstop misery, no sleep, extreme weather, and drill after drill where they're pushed past every single human limit, both mentally and physically. 80% of the men who enter SEAL training drop out, many because their bodies simply shut down. I met a SEAL once, and I asked him why they put themselves through such extreme circumstances, and I'll never forget what he told me. Because under pressure, you don't rise to the occasion, you sink to the level of your training. That is why we train so hard." "John, I wouldn't be a very good sensei if I did you the disservice of putting you through comfortable training every day, because later on, under pressure, you would crumble. I always get angry when I hear someone say, it's too hard. When they're faced with a choice to do something difficult in the moment that will pay off in the long run. Because I can guarantee you that no matter how hard it might be, the pain of regret after not doing it is much harder. It's much worse. Being broke is a lot harder than saving a percentage of every paycheck. Living with diabetes is a lot harder than limiting how much sugar you consume each day. And failing to come close to your God-given potential and ending up in a dead-end job that's robbing you of your time and slowly killing your heart is much harder than betting on yourself and taking the scary leap into what you know you should do with your life. You don't find any traffic after going the extra mile, and there's a very good reason for that. Most people won't do what it takes to get there. But if you choose to do what others won't, eventually you will get to do what others can't. Let me tell you a secret. People who get average results persist until things get uncomfortable. Then they quit. People who get good results persist until things get painful. Then they quit. But people who get world-class results have trained themselves to become comfortable when it is painful and uncomfortable. You can't cheat the grind. It knows how hard you've worked, and it won't give you anything you have not earned. This is why we shoot every day, no matter the weather, so that when the pressure comes and you sink to the level of your training, you really aren't sinking at all, but you are instead pushed up and supported by all those hours you've spent training so hard. John nodded, energized. Thank you, Akira Sensei. I'll work on learning to embrace what's uncomfortable now, knowing all the while that it's keeping me from the much bigger pain of regret later on. Chapter 10. Once a week, the apprentices were allowed to watch television. John and Akira started to form a bond watching American sports together. One of their favorite teams to watch was the LA Lakers. One night, Akira began to speak to the apprentices about the importance of creating a new scorecard for life. He pointed to Kobe Bryant as Kobe drained another three-pointer. Tell me, why is Kobe Bryant still playing basketball? The apprentices watched Kobe hustle. John answered, because he loves basketball? Yes, possibly, but he has repeatedly said that if he wins his sixth NBA title, then he will be satisfied and retire. Kobe isn't the only one who has fallen for this trap. Every day, people everywhere live their lives believing that everything will be different if they can just achieve more, win more, or make more money. But if achievement hasn't filled that void to date, how is achieving more going to fill it in the future? Like thirsty people guzzling salt water, achievement only creates a greater desire for accomplishing more, dehydrating us of true satisfaction and fulfillment. After Andre Agassi made it to number one in the world in tennis, he said, I thought that getting to number one was going to be the moment I had made sense of my life. But it left me a little empty, and I spiraled down. Have you ever noticed that some of the most outwardly beautiful people on earth seemingly have the most troubling relationships? Or that some of the wealthiest people have the most sleepless nights? A man from South Korea who played in three World Cups and in the English Premier League once told me in his broken English, Before I have money, I never worry about money. I get to the EPL and sign big contract. Then all I think about is money. It's not our place to judge, but it is wise to learn from those who have come before us. The scorecard society judges us by is tragically flawed, and pursuing it will leave you completely unfulfilled. It is time we develop a new scorecard for how we define a truly successful life. I want you to think about a few people that you truly admire and write out what characteristics they embody that you would like to be known for. John started to think about the people he truly admired, and he wrote down, courage, boldness, empathy, loving, grateful, persistence, joyful, and resourceful. Akira nodded. Now I want you to choose the top four characteristics that are most important to you. This was tough for John because he felt like all of the characteristics on his list were really important. But he finally wrote down, boldness and courage, loving, resourceful, persistence. Akira smiled as the apprentices finished writing. You now have your new scorecard. I want you to grade yourself twice a day on how you've done on the things that you have said are the most important characteristics for living a truly successful life. If you grade yourself around the middle of the day, then you will know what areas you need to focus on that evening. With this new scorecard, you can use any situation you find yourself in as an opportunity to grow these characteristics. In fact, the more challenging the situation, the greater the opportunity to grow your character. John took a blank 4x6 note card as they were being passed around and wrote out his new scorecard. He was excited because he now had a very practical tool for using any circumstance as an opportunity to develop into the man he wanted to become. Chapter 11.
One summer day, the weather was so hot and humid, the sensei actually told the apprentices to stop chopping wood and carrying water an hour early in order for everyone to spend some time in the nearby lake. On the way to the water, Akira asked John if anyone had told him the story of evil's best weapon. John said that no one had, and Akira smiled wide. "Then you are in for a treat." As they walked, he began his story. One day, an evil old witch was going out of business, and she had a yard sale to sell her potions and tools. You could buy all the traditional tools you could think of when you think of evil. Jealousy, anger, lust, pride, envy, deceit, and adultery. Droves of people flocked to the sale, and all her shiny tools were sold to the highest bidder. Towards the end of the day, after all the tools had been well picked through, all that remained were a few trash of heaps of old, worn-out, and broken tools. One gentleman dug through the scraps and found a tool that was very well worn and looked like it was on its last leg. Hoping for a good deal, he brought it to the woman to ask how much it cost. The old witch was startled. "That tool is too valuable for me to sell. It is the only one I'm passing down to my niece. Give it back to me. It should not have been out there." Now the man was even more intrigued. "But it's so worn, and yet you claim it's worth more than all these other shinier and newer tools? I must know what this tool is." The witch refused to tell him, and instead she pried it from his hands and asked him to leave. She took the old tool back and hid it in her house, and by the day's end, every other tool had been sold except for that one. A few months later, the witch was on her deathbed. She called for her niece. Her niece was very angry that she had sold all her fancy tools. "How could you sell all your tools and not pass them on to me?" she shouted. The old witch waited for her to calm down and then told her to look under her bed. The niece looked under the bed, but all she saw was an old, worn-out tool. She was surprised. This old thing is all you left me?" The old witch looked at her and said, "Oh, how naive you are. Young child, this tool is discouragement, and it is more powerful than all the other tools combined. The best part is that most people never suspect that it comes from you. Discouragement will allow you to get to a person's heart when none of the other tools will, and once they become discouraged, they are putty in your hands. You can squash the most powerful of dreams, level the greatest of ideas, and ruin almost anything in the world without detection, all by using this tool to plant the seeds of discouragement." And with nothing but that single tool of discouragement, her niece went on to become one of the most powerful witches to ever live. "John, one of the most powerful forces you will face during your time here is discouragement. It can come in many different forms. Sometimes it is the voice inside your head that says you aren't good enough, while other times it might come from giving your best and still not succeeding. Still other times it will creep in ways you might not even be aware of. But make sure you always keep your guard up and fuel your heart with encouragement." John nodded, asking, "How do I fuel my heart?" Akira smiled. "Great question. You fuel your heart with 6 things. What you watch, what you read, what you listen to, who you surround yourself with, how you talk to yourself, and what you visualize. Let me ask you a question. If you owned a Lamborghini, would you ever put water into the gas tank?" John looked up in confusion. "Of course not. That would ruin the engine." "Exactly," Akira said. "But that is what most people do with their hearts. You and I were created just like that Lamborghini. But if we put the wrong fuel into the gas tank of our hearts, we won't run as we were intended to. We get frustrated and discouraged because we know deep down that we were created for so much more. You were created perfectly and meticulously for a purpose, John, but if you put the wrong fuel into the gas tank of your heart, it's very easy to get discouraged and break down as you go through the journey of life." Chapter 12. On one particular tough day of training, John just couldn't seem to shoot as well as normal. His groupings were loose and unfocused. He became mentally distracted by the fit of his new shooting guard. As he finished the day in frustration, Akira took him aside and asked him how his day had been. "Terrible. I couldn't focus. I got distracted by my new shooting guard, and my groupings weren't as tight as they needed to be. I feel like a failure." Akira smiled and shrugged. "I didn't ask how you shot, John. But since you brought it up, what did you do well in training?" John paused, thrown off. He struggled to think of a single positive takeaway from the day's shooting. "Nothing. I did nothing well," he said, discouraged. "I have a very hard time believing that, John," said Akira. "Why do you think it's so hard for you to think of what you did well?" John shrugged. "I guess I don't think about it because I don't want to get a big head." Let me tell you something, John. I do.
John looked at his sensei in surprise and confusion as Akira continued. It's much easier for your brain to focus on the negatives, even if they are actually totally outweighed by the positives. Many people's confidence suffers because they are more concerned with appearing to be humble, so they have been conditioned to tell really negative stories about themselves and their performance. Now, there are people who have the reverse challenge and can't see their flaws, but far and away, the bigger issue is people who lack confidence and who are highly critical of themselves. But let's be clear, negativity and nothing I do is good enough attitude is not humility. A much smarter man than I said, humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. Let me tell you a couple secrets about how our marvelous brains actually work, John. Your memories are not created through your experiences. Rather, they are created through the stories you tell yourself and others about those experiences. So if you leave a practice or a match, and you tell everyone how poorly you played, and you focus on all your mistakes, that is what your brain remembers. Most people undermine all the hard work they are putting in by telling really negative stories and blocking out all the growth that is happening. Akira smiled. What do you mean, blocking out? Said John as his nose scrunched and his eyebrows furrowed inquisitively. Our brains are marvelous machines, John, which process around 11 million bits of information per second, but we are only aware of about 40 of those bits. In other words, you and I are only aware of 0.000364 of what is actually happening around us. You and I block out 99.99999% of what our brain is processing. So if we want to change the way our brains scan the world and start to adopt a more beneficial reality and perspective, we must start by rewiring the way our brain scans the world around us. Well, that sounds incredibly challenging. How in the world do you do that? Asked John. Akira handed him a small notepad and pen. By writing it down. John flipped through the blank pages as Akira went on. I want you to do this after every shooting session. I want you to start by writing a value statement at the top. It should say, my value comes from who I am, not from what I do. Then follow that with a growth mindset statement. Anything that happens to me today is in my best interest and an opportunity to learn and grow. Then I want you to write out between 15 to 63 specific things you did well. John blinked, taken back. Whoa, that's a lot. I think that might be impossible. Of course it feels that way. That's because you haven't trained your brain to think that way yet. Do you remember the first time you tried to make a left-hand layup in basketball? Asked Akira. John blushed and mumbled. Yes, I was 11 years old and I started to cry. Truthfully, I started bawling and ran out of the gym. I thought the guy who trained me was a jerk, but he made me keep doing it for months, often through crying fits of frustration. Sounds like a tough trainer. Did it get easier, though? Yes, eventually I became highly skilled with finishing with my left hand. In time, this will get easier as you consistently force your brain to scan the world differently. But until then, I encourage you to always keep going until you have at least 15 things. If you decide to quit before 15, make sure you at least get two more than where you quit the day before. Remember, this is rewiring your brain. It is hard work, but it is very worth it. One thing that might be helpful is to carry this notebook with you and jot things down as you go through practice, your day, or during breaks in competition. You may not need to write them all the way out during competition or practice, but write down enough to remember what you complete your journal later that day. And remember, John, you have ignored what you have done well for a long time while blowing your flaws out of proportion. So maybe for the next 6 months, let's try and do the reverse. Let's ignore some of the flaws and focus on finding what you did well and how you got better. That's helpful, actually. I think I can do that, said John. The next part of the journal is writing out two areas for growth, but you only get to write these down once you get to 15 specific things you've done well. You only get two areas because it's hard to remember to focus on more than two at any one time. By writing down only two areas, you can look back at yesterday's journal and know exactly what you need to focus on today during training. Finally, the last thing you write out is at least two things you learned today. Because remember, nothing is a test. Everything is an opportunity to learn. But we need to actually focus on learning, Akira said with a big smile. John, it takes a lot of discipline to stick with a What Went Well journal, but it is a very rewarding exercise with far-reaching implications for your life. If you can't see what you do well, it's awful hard to encourage other people what they do well.
Chapter 13.
Another year passed, and John kept growing and learning. Every morning he chopped wood, and every evening he carried water. His hands developed thick calluses, his arms grew stronger, and his movements became fluid and memorized as his brain wrapped intricate wires of muscle memory called myelin. One night during the summer, John and the sensei didn't find any games they wanted to watch on TV, so they decided on a new Karate Kid movie starring Jaden Smith. During a commercial break, Akira told John about his admiration for Jaden's father, Will. In an interview, he once heard Will say, "Talent, you have naturally. Skill is only developed by hours and hours and hours of beating on your craft." Will went on, "I've never considered myself particularly talented, but where I excel is ridiculous, sickening work ethic. There's no easy way around it. No matter how talented you are, your talent is going to fail you if you're not skilled." John grew up watching reruns of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and he always considered Will Smith to be one of those talented people to whom everything just came naturally. He asked Akira, "So do you think someone like Will Smith really isn't that talented?" His sensei replied, "I think he might have plenty of talent, but I think that talent is overshadowed by his character. A wise man once told me, talent without character is like an expensive fast car with no gas. It is useless without the fuel that drives it." John nodded as Akira went on, "And while I do not know what anyone is born with, I do know that none of us know our potential. In fact, I would argue that your potential is much greater than you ever realize, but it will take incredible dedication and purposeful training to unlock it. Most people never realize their potential because when things get hard or they experience failure, they just quit. Most people settle for average and what comes easy. They never give their very, very best and exhaust themselves in order to protect their ego. They enjoy being able to say, 'I didn't even really try,' or 'I didn't even really care,' because if they did really give it their best and still failed, that would be too much for their ego to handle." John felt like he had just uncovered one of the greatest secrets to success. "I guess it makes sense now that you explain it like that, because with things like Instagram and YouTube, we only see the most edited Photoshop versions of people's lives. It feels like they wake up like that, but really everything is staged. They took 50 pictures and highly edited the very best one. No one posts anything of them not looking their best today." Akira nodded his approval. "Exactly. Never forget, you do not shine under the bright lights. The bright lights only reveal your work in the dark. We get so used to seeing superstars on game day that we forget what we do not see. All the hours they spend beating on their craft, drenched in sweat, at the point of exhaustion, with no one watching. Too many people seek exposure from the bright lights, but the bright lights only expose their lack of faithfulness to their craft in the dark." Chapter 14. After that evening, John went to bed with a renewed sense of excitement to chop wood, carry water, and beat on his craft. Over the next couple of months, he still had his days that were more challenging than others, but overall, he was in a much better place. Eventually, though, John developed a wandering eye. One of his fellow apprentices, a young man named Katsu, he seemed to consistently be achieving things faster than John. His shots were stronger and more accurate, and he didn't complain or grow tired of his work. It seemed like he was always doing everything better than John. And he wasn't the only one. John started looking at all of his friends and began to grow jealous at how things came so easily for them and how hard things were for him. One day, John was walking to lunch when Akira came up beside him. "Why the heavy shoulders, John? It looks like something is really weighing on you." John sulked. "I've really been struggling the last few months because it just feels like it's not fair that I work so hard, yet other people who are more talented than me continue to surpass me with less effort. Do you know how embarrassing it is to be busting my butt every day and giving my everything to get better? And it never feels good enough. I watch Katsu give half the effort and he's still better than me. I just feel like I should quit, go home, and get a normal job. Maybe becoming a samurai archer just isn't for me." Akira stopped, spun John around by his shoulders, and stared deep into his soul with his piercing gray eyes. "Let me tell you a story, John. When I was your age, I was the last in my class. In everything. I struggled. I wanted to quit. I was constantly embarrassed because I gave everything, but it never felt good enough." "So how did you get so good?" John said. "I never gave up, and I realized the whole time I was building my own house. A sensei shared with me the very same story about Koda building his own house, and I realized it wasn't about what I was doing, but rather who I was becoming. John, let me tell you two very important things. Comparison is the thief of all joy, and the grass isn't greener on the other side. The grass is greener where you water it. You have grown up in a society where things like social media and 24-hour television have established a culture that is hyper-focused on comparison. But if you're constantly comparing, you'll have all the joy sucked out of you. You must focus on your journey, yours alone. If you don't, you risk not only losing your joy, but losing any chance of true success in the long run. Comparison is incredibly short-sighted, and if we focus only on the successes of others, we do it at our own expense. As a great writer once said, there is nothing noble in being superior to your fellow man. True nobility is being superior to your former self. The person who chops wood and carries water, no matter if up by 20 points or down by 20 points, crushes the field in the long run. But more importantly, crushes the version of themselves focused on just winning. It's worthless to compare to others. The real comparison is to ourself. Which philosophy, belief, or mindset is most beneficial to you over the long haul? Are you playing the short game or the long game? Compare yourself and measure yourself compared only to your potential, not to that of your competition or your teammates. He continued stern, "If it rains, bottle the water and sell it. If crap falls from the sky, package it and sell fertilizer. If it is sunny, plant a garden. Use what you and you alone have been given. You do not know what other people are going through, and everyone has their own unique struggles. Even Katsu, stop trying to live their life, because there are millions of people who would give anything to live your life. Do you know there are billions of people without access to clean drinking water, and millions of people with debilitating diseases and accidents that have left them paralyzed?" John perked up, and he got tears in his eyes as he thought about Jordan. He would give anything for the opportunity John was complaining about. "I guess I got so distracted with the people who seemingly have more than me that I forgot about those with less than me." You must always keep perspective, John. It is very easy to lose it. And when you lose perspective, you forget that life is but a vapor. We are here today and gone tomorrow. Do not waste your life, John. Focus on what truly matters and do not fall for the lies of the comparison thief. I want you to try an exercise I do every morning in the shower that helps me shift from comparison to a heart posture of gratitude. I call it gratefulness meditation. I want you to sit down in the shower for 5 to 10 minutes every morning and start by thanking God for everything you can think of. I usually start with the little things that are easy to take for granted, like clean drinking water, the ability to walk, talk, and feed myself. I even thank Him for all the doors that have closed in my life. Eventually, I just slip into a meditative state and try to just observe the thoughts that fly through my mind without judging them. If I have a tough day, I will usually visualize whatever challenges are likely to arise, and then I see myself overcoming them and being at my very best, focusing on what I have 100% control over. John had a puzzled look on his face. "I know it sounds strange, but I've been doing it for over 3 decades, and it works." Okay. I promise to try it out for at least 2 weeks, and I will let you know how it goes. Chapter 15. One day, just as the apprentices reached the shooting range, the sky cracked with thunder and began pouring down rain like John had never seen before. Everyone was instructed to go into the dining hall once they arrived. They were asked to be seated. Up on the board was written, "Talent versus skill." As the apprentices settled in, Akira began to teach, speaking about how the difference between talent and skill is widely misunderstood. Many people think that all you need is talent, and that only the chosen few can ever truly succeed. Many talented people believe the same thing, and then get frustrated when they fail because they think that all they need to do is show up, and everything will magically line up for them because of their talent. After everyone was dismissed, John waited around to talk with the old sensei. John was bubbling over with excitement. "As you were talking, I remembered that Michael Jordan got cut from his high school basketball team. He even had a commercial once where he said, 'Maybe it's my fault. Maybe I led you to believe that basketball was a God-given gift and not something that I worked for every single day of my life.' Many people thought the commercial was MJ going after LeBron James. And sure enough, LeBron James' work ethic and willingness to sacrifice increased dramatically since that commercial. It wasn't until he had that shift that he actually won an NBA championship. Very interesting, mused Akira. I didn't know that, but it doesn't surprise me. I always wondered what happened, but I had never heard that commercial or MJ quote before. Maybe it did have something to do with LeBron's shift in mentality and work ethic. It was still pouring rain outside, so Akira asked John if he wanted to join him by the fire. John agreed, loading a few logs into the furnace. They sat, enjoying the warmth of the flames in the chilly dining hall. Akira asked, "John, you love golf, don't you?" John replied, "Yes, absolutely. My dad, Jordan, and I grew up playing every Friday, and it developed a special bond between us. Jordan loved to watch us play." The old man smiled as John spoke of the warm memories he and his family shared on the course. Finally, he asked, "But do you know the story of how golf balls were first made?" "I don't think I do," John realized. Akira continued, "At first, golf balls were made smooth, without any dimples at all. But eventually, during testing, one man started to notice something strange. He developed a theory about it, and one day he came into work early to test his theory, because he thought that everyone would think he was crazy if he shared it with them. His theory was that the golf balls that had been hit many times, the bruised and rough ones, actually traveled much further than the perfectly smooth ones did. Sure enough, he was right. These tiny imperfections create a thin layer of turbulence around the ball, reducing drag and allowing air to flow further and more smoothly around the ball. And that is why today, all golf balls have dimples on them." John, I know you are afraid of your perceived weaknesses and shortcomings, and you feel like your journey has always taken you up the rough side of the mountain. But when you don't give up and you don't give in, the rough side of the mountain actually molds you and shapes you into a person who can travel much further in life, just like those roughed up golf balls. The blemishes, scars, and setbacks are what give you the character to take you places other people are too soft and smooth to go. John nodded, feeling a weight lift gently off his shoulders as Akira spoke. "Are you still struggling with comparing yourself to other people who things come more easily to?" his sensei asked. "I'm doing a lot better since I started doing the gratefulness meditation every morning, but it's still hard at times." "I think talent is often more of a curse than a blessing, John. Did you know that most people who win the lottery are worse off financially 5 years down the road than they were before winning the lottery?" "I never knew that." "Winning the lottery skips the valuable process of going up the rough side of the mountain. Instead of being forced to learn and develop the skills necessary for creating or sustaining success, you arrive at the top, without any of it what it takes to stay there. Talent can be a kind of lottery, John. A talented athlete is often less likely to develop the skills and work ethic that a less talented one has to develop just to survive. And because of that, they may end up much worse off down the road. They never learn the work ethic, persistence, and grit needed to overcome the inevitable challenges that life throws their way. Remember, greatness isn't for the chosen few, but for the few who consistently and persistently choose. I know that it seems like life is unfair right now, and you want things to be easier, but the rough side of the mountain will actually prepare you for life much better than the smooth side. Believe it or not, the setbacks of today can quickly become the forging blades of greatness for tomorrow. In fact, a wise man once said, "Hardships often prepare ordinary people for an extraordinary destiny." "Wow, I never thought of it that way before," John pondered. "I guess I need to rethink my setbacks. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and perspective. I'm not sure I would have made it this far without you." Akira just smiled, nodding patiently. "My blessing." Chapter 16. One evening, John and Akira had gone on a long walk after dinner to the edge of the property to catch the sunset. As they watched the sun drop to the horizon, Akira pointed to a large oak tree, which had been uprooted and lay fallen at the edge of the property. He asked, "Do you see that tree, John?" "Of course. What happened to it?" "A very strong wind blew it over many, many years ago. But after that same windstorm, a company in the city came out and set up those. Do you know what they are?" Akira pointed in the other direction across a field. Far away, John could glimpse the spinning turbines of a wind farm. "A wind farm?" "Exactly. Isn't it strange, John, that wind can be both creative and destructive at the same time? It all depends on how you harness it. It can destroy homes or trees, or it can create power or push a sailboat across an ocean.
John nodded. I never thought of it that way.
Akira continued, words are a lot like that. Just like the wind, they are everywhere. We use them every day to talk to others, but most importantly, we use them to talk to ourselves. And just like the wind, their power can either destroy or create. You may not have control over how other people talk to you, but you do have control over how you talk to yourself. And that is hugely important because words put pictures in your mind. Pictures in your mind impact how you feel. How you feel impacts what you do. What you habitually do impacts your destiny. What amazes me is that many people, often without realizing it, use this power to talk themselves into choices that are harmful for themselves in the long run, even if they might offer temporary happiness. Or they use their words to give power to their inner critic, destroying their own joy and growth before it even has a chance to start. What do you mean? Asked John. Well, John, we're all experts in mental training because we practice it every day. Most people just aren't aware of it. Our brains can't distinguish between what is real and imagined, and we can actually wrap muscle memory with vivid visualization. You use visualization every single day, though you might be only using it in negative ways. How so? Asked John. Do you ever worry, John? Worrying is a form of negative visualization that helps create the scenario you see happening in your mind. The hard choice, but the one that is best for us in the long run, is to use our words to put positive pictures in our minds and to talk to ourselves in ways that push us toward growth and toward what is most beneficial for ourselves in the long run. It might sound crazy at first, but using beneficial and constructive self-talk instead of giving power to our inner critic is one of the most formidable strategies possible to use towards reaching our fullest potential. You might not be able to stop negative thoughts or your inner critic from screaming at you, but you don't have to believe them. And you can definitely talk to yourself rather than just listening to the negativity. John nodded, understanding. Just like the wind? Akira smiled. Yes, John, just like the wind.
Chapter 17. One night, John was watching TV alone when a commercial came on. It was a loud advertisement for a product that promised its users they could lose 20 pounds in just 2 weeks. Suddenly, a voice sounded from behind him. What a ridiculous idea.
John whirled around in surprise to find Akira standing at the doorway. The sensei entered the room, shaking his head. Those commercials always frustrate me and remind me of something. Have you ever seen a person order a 2,000 or 3,000 calorie meal, complete with a huge dessert, but then ask for a Diet Coke? What is that Diet Coke possibly doing for them? It might make them feel better, but it's not helping them get better. Unfortunately, John, this is how most people treat mental training. Sensing John's confusion, Akira explained, most people want to consume whatever they want to for 86,000 seconds of their day, just like they want to eat what they want to eat for most of each day. But then, just like this commercial offers, a get fit quick fix for a fat body, they want a trick they can do for the other 400 seconds left in their day that is going to override all the negative training they've been doing all day long. John nodded, understanding as Akira went on. Mental training is not magic. It is deliberate, intentional, and extremely hard training. If I told you it would be easy to lose 150 pounds, you would think I was crazy, just like you do when you watch these commercials. It's the same with mental training and developing true mental toughness. It's not sexy, it's dirty, hard work. The commercial ended and John smiled. So you're sure I can't lose 20 pounds in 2 weeks? Akira just looked at John's athletic frame and smiled back. If you lost 20 pounds, what would be left?
Chapter 18. Even though John enjoyed his time with Akira, it took 4 very long and very frustrating years before he was able to move up from the 7-foot target to the full targets more than 100 feet away. When the day finally came, John couldn't wait. He walked to the firing line filled with confidence, drawing his arrow smooth and quick. With a smile, he released it, only to watch in total disappointment as it flew sideways, totally off target. He couldn't believe it. He'd been shooting every day for 4 years, and now the bow and arrow felt like foreign objects in his hands. Once again, he wondered if all this time had been a waste. For weeks, he couldn't hit the target. Every day he tried, and every day his arrows flared all over the place. Then one day, Akira went over to check on his progress. John shrugged in total discouragement. I can't hit the target, and I feel like giving up.
Maybe I'm just not meant to be a samurai archer. John expected Akira to respond with some of his usual words of wisdom, but instead the old sensei beckoned John to follow him. He walked away from the firing line to a patch of dirt. He bent down and used an arrow to draw something in the dirt. John peered at the drawings curiously. They looked like this. "What I want," with an arrow pointed straight upwards and to the right. "How it feels," tons of squiggly lines all over. "How it actually works." A short growth spurt, a slight dip, and then a long plateau. The path to mastery. "What is that?" "That," replied Akira, "is the path to mastery." He explained that while John wanted to feel constant improvement, mastery moves much differently. It moves in steps, not constants. So while John might feel discouraged now, he was on a long plateau, and in time, he would eventually have another growth spurt. But John was tired of all the philosophical sayings and stories, and he couldn't believe the words that slipped out of his mouth. "You make it sound so easy, but I bet you can't even hit the target anymore, old man." Akira calmly responded, "Meet me back here at 10 tonight." Chapter 19. All day long, John couldn't shake his nerves. He knew he shouldn't have spoken to any sensei that way, but especially not the one who had invested so much time and energy in him. John was fearful of what would come next. Half expecting to be beaten, John showed up at the shooting range a few minutes early to scout the scene. At 9:59, Akira walked up silently, holding his bow and two arrows. John was confused because it was pitch black outside. You could barely see to walk. But Akira calmly walked over to one of the shooting blocks, knocked an arrow, and drew his bow. John watched in awe as, all at once, with intense focus that still seemed effortless somehow, Akira exhaled and released. Thwack! John knew that sound. Akira had hit the target. But it seemed impossible. Once again, the old man knocked his arrow, drew it, and thwack! This time the noise wasn't as loud, but John knew it must have hit something. He took off running to the target, and when he got there, he couldn't believe his eyes. It seemed impossible. Akira's first arrow was lodged in the middle of the target, while a second had hit the first arrow, splitting it in half. John walked back stunned, stuttering, "How on earth did you do that? It's impossible." Akira smiled, pointing down in the dirt to where his drawings were still clear. With nothing but a little bit of moonlight, he indicated the steps of the final drawing, many years of chop wood, carry water. He indicated the bottom step, first year you must learn to aim with your eyes. He indicated the next step, second year you must learn to draw your bow smoothly, hold it stable, and aim with your muscles. Again, the next step, third year you must learn to breathe slowly, control your diaphragm, and aim with your lungs. He repeated this all the way to the top of the drawing where he stopped. "John, I have been chopping wood and carrying water for 49 years, and while you may only aim with your eyes and your muscles and your lungs right now, I aim with everything. The way I stand, the position of my feet, how much tension I put in the bow, how much tension I have in my hands, how I breathe, and what I see in my mind all impact the end result. Everything impacts everything. Everything is aiming. You have much to learn, John. Get some sleep, and tomorrow we chop wood, carry water." John just nodded in total amazement, thankful for such a masterful and patient teacher. Chapter 20. The next morning at breakfast, Akira told John to meet him at the Big Bamboo Grove in 10 minutes. Still mesmerized from the night before, John quickly agreed. When John arrived 7 minutes later, Akira was already there waiting for him. "Let's go for a walk. I want to tell you a story," he said. John replied, "First, I owe you an apology. I am very sorry for speaking to you in such a disrespectful manner. It was wrong, and I'm so sorry." The old man looked at John and said with a smile, "I appreciate that you recognize this on your own, and I accept your apology. Now, has anyone ever told you the story of bamboo, John?" He pointed to the towering grove of bamboo trees with their thick green trunks and whispering leaves. John shook his head. "No, sir." "Well, then you are in for a treat," Akira grinned and went on. "You see, many people love bamboo. They love the bamboo trees, and they love the bamboo wood. but very few people understand the process of growing bamboo. You dig up the soil and you make sure it is good soil. Then you plant the bamboo seed. Then you must faithfully water it every day. And after 3 months, guess what starts to happen? John said excitedly, "The bamboo tree starts to sprout up out of the ground." Nope, nothing. You see absolutely nothing. You keep watering it and watering it, but you continue to see nothing happening for 1 year, then 2 years, then 3 years. Do you know what happens after 3 years, John? John replied more tentatively this time, "The bamboo tree starts to sprout up out of the ground?" Nothing. You see absolutely nothing. John shook his head. "I don't understand." What you don't see happening is what is taking place beneath the surface. Beneath the surface, a massive, dense foundation of roots is spreading out all throughout the ground to prepare for the rapid growth that the bamboo will experience. So you keep watering it and watering it, and eventually, after 5 years of seeing nothing at all happen above the surface, the bamboo tree shoots up to over 90 feet tall in just 6 weeks. You see, John, most people want the 90-foot bamboo tree without the 5 years of the process. They want the bamboo to grow to 90 feet tall in 6 weeks. But without the 5 years of invisible growth, the bamboo wouldn't have a solid foundation, and it could never sustain the massive and rapid growth that occurs. This is why you see people who achieve massive levels of quote-unquote success end up broke, homeless, and divorced. Did you know that around 75% of NFL players and around 65% of NBA players end up broke, homeless, and divorced? Shaken, John shook his head. No. Do you remember when I told you that the majority of people who win the lottery end up worse off financially than they were before winning the lottery, just 5 years down the road? John nodded. Of course he remembered. John, chopping wood and carrying water is the price of admission for the opportunity to reach sustained excellence. Like the roots of a bamboo tree, it is a long and arduous process of invisible growth where you are building the foundation that is necessary to sustain success. For many years, it might feel as if nothing is happening, but you must trust the process and continue to chop wood and carry water day in, day out, regardless of what is happening around you. There will be distractions. There will be people who tell you that you are stupid or crazy for doing it. There will be people who try and lure you off the path with quick fixes and get-rich-quick schemes. But you must be wise and stay the path and continue to build your foundation by chopping wood and carrying water every day. Greatness isn't sexy, John. It is the dirty hard work that is boring and often done in the dark. You have a bright future, but you must walk a dark and often lonely path and never forget. I know, interrupted John. No matter what happens, I must chop wood and carry water. Akira couldn't help but grin. You have learned much, but you still have much to learn. Chapter 21. On a beautiful fall day, while John was out training, Akira sat nearby, watching as John shot arrow after arrow. Eventually, he grabbed 2 cups of water and handed one to John. Time for a break. John was happy to oblige, and they sat in silence for a minute. Then Akira said, "Have I told you lately that I love to watch you shoot and that I'm so very proud of you?" John's face turned a little red as he replied, "Yes, you tell me every week." "Good." Akira nodded. "Do you know that I drove trucks all over Asia for 2 years when I was in my early 20s? "Really? I didn't know they even had cars back then." John grinned at his own joke as Akira shook his head. "I'm not that old, John. Need I remind you about our night of shooting in the dark?" "Of course not. I'll never forget that." The interesting thing about driving trucks back then was that without navigational technology, we depended a lot on road signs to help us. You would often snap out of a haze and wonder, "Wait a minute, am I going in the right direction?" He looked off for a minute, and then he continued. The same thing often happens with people in their teams, businesses, corporations, and families. The road signs on the path to mastery are similar regardless of the context we find ourselves in at any particular time in life. We can take solace in knowing that we are going in the right direction by the signs on the road. Here are some of those signs. "This is hard. I don't feel like fill in the blank today. Everyone else has more time than me. I don't feel like this is making a difference. Almost no one else is doing this. Sound familiar? The thing about all of these signs is that they provide information, but they don't give a whole lot of instruction. Instead, they are more like the mile markers or rest stop signs that tell us where things are. But the great thing about most highways is that they don't just provide information, they actually provide instruction that will help us move safely and efficiently towards our destination. These are the yellow diamond signs that we see instructing us about a speed change for a sharp bend, uneven roads, or road work ahead. The road signs on the path to mastery are no different. So what are some of those on the path to mastery? Talk to yourself instead of listen to yourself. Ask the question, what is one thing I can do to make this better, rather than, why is this happening to me? Live by principles rather than feelings. Finally, there are warning signs that mark the path. They are signs that warn us about the result of our choices. On the highway, we see warnings about fines in a work zone, fines for littering, and fines for HOV violators. They are the boundaries that we must operate in, or else there will be a consequence. The path to mastery is marked with those as well. Your choice creates your challenge. You are building your own house. Your choice creates a challenge for those on your team. You will reap what you sow. The grass is greener where you water it. The wise man finds the diamonds on his own land. Even though the path to mastery is available to everyone, very few will choose to take it. Will there be obstacles? Yes. Will there be people who try and hold you back? Yes. Will there be circumstances that create challenges outside of your control? Yes. Will it be lonely at times? Yes. But choosing to believe that anything that happens is in your best interest will turn all of those challenges and circumstances into a refinery that will shape your character and skills and will develop within you an ability to change the world. John nodded, amazed. Then a smile grew on his face as he began to laugh. Is something funny, John? He looked at his sensei and grinned. Sure is. I just pictured you in a trucker hat. Akira began to laugh as well. Aren't you glad I didn't stick with trucking? I know I am. Chapter 22. A few more years passed, and John had begun to hit the far target with some consistency, becoming more and more accurate. His excitement grew because the annual apprentice tournament was coming up, and he felt like it would be his time to finally shine and prove to everyone how good he had become. But that week, John really began to struggle with a concept he had just learned in training. A sensei had talked about the need to be fully absorbed in the moment. The way he described it, it was almost as if the greatest samurai archers arrived at a place where they were so fully absorbed in the moment that they melded with the bow and arrow, so that there were no longer two separate things, but the two had become one. It reminded John of a concept he had been taught at a basketball mental skills workshop in high school. The teacher had shared the importance of playing present. He told John that the majority of people feel pressure and never come close to playing to their potential because they never play present. Instead, they play in the past or the future, which is where they feel pressure. There is no such thing as pressure in the present moment. John didn't understand how to play present, but had made a commitment to himself to try to learn how. He'd even reached out to a few people on Twitter, trying to discover how to be more effective at playing present. His favorite response said, "Sit in the front row away from friends and teammates, turn off your phone, and take notes by hand, for every class." One afternoon, John was so absorbed with his thinking, he nearly ran headfirst into a tree on his way to the shooting range. Stumbling, he caught himself as, "Good catch. I thought you were going down there." It was Akira, who had seen the whole thing and couldn't help but let out a little belly laugh. John joined in with red embarrassment as he continued, "What are you thinking about? It must be something big if you're walking into trees thinking about it." John started explaining how confused he was by the concept of playing present. He shared that favorite response from years ago about sitting in the front row. Akira nodded quizzical. "So, did you do what he told you to?" John squirmed a bit, mumbling something indiscernible. Akira said, "I didn't think you had with any consistency, or you wouldn't be struggling with the concept today. Here's what you must understand what he was trying to teach. To play present, you must learn to live present. Remember, you are always training." John nodded, realizing something. "I'm also late. Now I have to go chop wood, carry water. He bowed to his sensei and turned to leave. But Akira wasn't finished. Excuse me? He said. John, there is only one thing you have to do in life, and that is die. You are always doing what you want to do, because there is always a choice. You may not like the choices or the consequences, but you always have a choice. When you tell yourself that you have to do something, it creates a negative internal energy. But when you realize you want to do something, it creates a more beneficial internal energy. John nodded. Then let me correct myself. I want to go chop wood and carry water. Akira smiled, watching his apprentice go, proud of how John had transformed. Chapter 23. The day before the big apprentice tournament, John was on a walk with Akira. How are you feeling about the tournament? He asked. Great. I put in the work in the dark, and now it's my time to shine under the bright lights. My goal is to win the tournament, and I think I finally have the skill to accomplish it. Akira pondered that for a silent moment, then replied, Do you know why so many people love goals, John? Because they secretly let them off the hook. If your goal is to become a doctor, there are a lot of people who can stop that from happening. There are many checkpoints along the way where people can tell you that you aren't smart enough or that you don't qualify. But if you look at Mother Teresa's mission, to serve the needs of the sick and the dying, no one could ever stop her from living that out. Goals actually allow you to shirk responsibility, but a mission? Only the person in the mirror can stop you from living that out. I think one of the reasons so many young people today are floundering around chasing all the wrong things is because they are bored with goals. They need a compelling mission. 100 years ago, teenagers were leading armies, raising families, and living inspired lives. They might have lived boring lives by today's standards, but I would argue many of them were inspired by a compelling mission from a very young age. Today, our parents and coaches do all sorts of things to shelter kids from the consequences of their choices and rarely inspire them with a mission. I believe a mission is something you can do right where you are, anywhere, using only what you have. You don't need anyone's permission. So what is your mission, John? It's much deeper than a goal, and it's okay to borrow one from others and then refine it as you go. But your mission will act as your internal navigation system. Without a mission, you will flounder through life and very easily end up with your ladder on the oh shoot building. John was surprised but couldn't help cracking up. What building is that? He asked. Many people keep climbing and climbing only to get to the end of their life and the top of the ladder and realize their ladder has been on the wrong building. Without a mission, it's easy to lose perspective on what truly matters. A mission will make you think beyond the moment, which is greatly important because the only thing that is significant about the moment is who you become in the process and the impact you have on others. No one on their deathbed is worried about how they did in a game, on a test, or how much money they made. They care about their relationships and who they have become as a person. I know that in the moment, the achievements feel like a big deal, but with perspective, you will realize just how insignificant they are. John nodded, but in all honesty, his mind was still set on the tournament the next day. Do you understand what I mean? Asked Akira. John said he did, but Akira knew better. John's mind was elsewhere. He sighed, knowing what was coming, but knowing that he had to let John experience it on his own. Oftentimes, failure is the greatest teaching tool. Chapter 24. Sure enough, when the tournament came around, John just couldn't seem to perform as well as he knew he could. Anxiety got the best of him, and after blowing his first three rounds, he wasn't even close to hitting the target by the end of it. So instead of winning, or even placing, he watched in jealousy as Katsu's arrows slammed into the bullseye, winning him the tournament. As John walked off, emotion overcame him like a tidal wave, and tears of pure frustration began to fall. He had worked so hard for the last 6 years, and now he felt like he was back at square one, shooting at a 7-foot target. Lost in frustration, he walked for miles, ending up at the edge of the community's property. He collapsed at the top of a beautiful overlook, exhausted. He was so worn out that he eventually dozed off. A while later, a familiar voice roused him. John. Sure enough, it was Akira. He offered John a bottle of water and a sandwich. I figured you might be out here. The old man gestured to the surrounding hills, rolling in miles in every direction. When I was an apprentice, I too used to come up here when I was frustrated with my training. John began to eat and drink as Akira continued. John, I knew this was going to happen. As soon as you told me your goal was to win the tournament last week, I knew you had allowed your focus to shift away from the process and onto the uncontrollables. You cannot play present if you are focused on winning or the outcome. As the sun began to set, the sky ignited with an explosion of color. Akira looked into John's eyes. I want you to do something for me, John. I want you to go for a 2-minute gratefulness walk. I want you to walk around for 2 minutes thanking God for everything you are grateful for. And make sure you pay special attention to all those little things we often take for granted. You mean like gratefulness meditation? Exactly. John nodded. After 2 minutes, he returned with a huge smile on his face. That was amazing. I could feel the energy inside of me shift. Akira nodded. Remember that the next time you are struggling and need a perspective shift. It's not just what you do, but it's also the heart posture you have while doing it. If you broke your legs, I bet you would give anything to be able to just go for a walk. But it is easy to lose perspective and focus on silly things like the results of a tournament rather than on being grateful for even being able to participate in the tournament in the first place. When you operate with a heart posture of gratefulness and gratitude, you free yourself up to be at your very best and slip into the zone. Not to mention, you're also much more of a joy to be around for those you love. John nodded as he took in the sunset. Akira thought for a minute, then said, John, I want to share with you the most important piece of wisdom my sensei ever shared with me. The ultimate illusion of the human experience is control. The person you want beside you in battle is the guy who has surrendered the outcome and surrendered to the fact that he might die. When you surrender the outcome, you are freed up to be at your best, to be in the moment, and to trust your training. It is the one who has surrendered the outcome who ironically has the greatest chance of survival. It is the one who has surrendered the outcome who has the greatest chance of success. It is the one who has surrendered to the fact that he could fail, who has the greatest likelihood of not failing. Until you surrender the outcome, you will always be the greatest enemy to your own success. In order to reach your greatest potential, you must operate with a heart posture of gratitude, commit to the controllables, surrender the outcome, and trust the process. Surrendering the outcome doesn't mean you care less about the outcome or your process. It doesn't mean you don't give your very, very best. It simply means that you have surrendered the outcomes that are outside of your control. Many mornings, I pray and surrender things that I desperately want to control, but I know I don't have control over. Surrendering the outcome is about having peace with that which is outside of your control without sacrificing the effort or care of what is inside of your control. Chapter 25. The week after the tournament, the community buzzed because of a special guest they were hosting for the week. Jackie Chan was going to be arriving later that day and speaking to the group that night, and John couldn't be more excited to get to meet him. When Jackie got up to speak, he said he wanted to talk to them about the importance of failure, and that failure can be an incredible launching pad if you have a growth mindset. He said that a growth mindset is believing that anything that happens to me is in my best interest and an opportunity to learn and grow. Mr. Chan began to share a list of people who became famous after persevering through many continuous failures. It was 1937 when Theodore Gazelle's first book hit the market after being rejected 26 times by different publishers. He went on to write a few books you might have read, such as Cat in the Hat, Green Eggs and Ham, and Oh, the Places We Will Go. Einstein's teachers labeled him mentally slow. He didn't speak until almost 5 years old, and he was expelled from school. Ben Carson was told he was stupid by teachers and made to sit in the back corners of classrooms. He eventually became the first neurosurgeon to ever separate Siamese twins attached at the skull. Oprah was fired and told she was unfit for television. David Sanders' famous chicken recipes were rejected by over 1,000 different restaurants, but you've probably eaten at a KFC. A young engineer named Soichiro wanted a certain engineering job at Toyota, and he was very upset he didn't get it. So he left and started a brand using his last name, Honda. Henry had multiple businesses fail under his leadership, but eventually he created a little company called Ford. Walt was fired from a local Kansas City newspaper for lacking creativity and having no original ideas. Mr. Disney's original ideas still draw billions to his amusement parks and movies every single year. At 30 years old, Steve was fired from the company he created until Apple begged him to come back and save the company 10 years later. Tom was told he was too stupid to learn anything, but Mr. Edison did invent the first light bulb, along with at least 1,093 other things. Their group was told they have no future in show business, but I bet the person who told the Beatles might have eventually found himself with no future in show business. Stephen was rejected from the University of Southern California 3 times and eventually dropped out of another college. He created a few movies you might have seen, like Jaws, Jurassic Park, and Indiana Jones. Roland had 7 straight businesses fail before he started Macy's. A young singer named Paul's sample tape was continuously rejected by record labels as not suitable for us. But those same companies perked up their ears when Bono and his band U2 eventually became some of the most successful rock stars of all time. Akio's company was so broke, they started making rice cookers that didn't work very well at all. But after many years of barely keeping the lights on, Sony found their niche. Winston failed the 6th grade and was beaten in every election he partook in until becoming the prime minister. His last name, Churchill, is now synonymous with the stalwart leadership that helped the Allies defeat Hitler in World War II. Abraham failed at seemingly everything he put his hand to, including multiple businesses and runs at office. But President Lincoln eventually got a couple things right, like saving the Union and the Emancipation Proclamation. Jerry froze his first time up on the big stage and was consequently booed off it. His television show, About Nothing, was laughed at and ridiculed until Seinfeld became one of the longest-running and most popular shows in television history. Vincent only sold 1 painting during his lifetime and was a true starving artist, but today Van Gogh's paintings together are worth billions. Mr. Presley was fired from the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville and told to go back to driving a truck. Elvis was able to buy many trucks in his lifetime while selling a couple records along the way. A shoe company was on the brink of bankruptcy for over a decade before they really took off, and Nike is still doing pretty well to this day. Ludwig was completely deaf, which made playing the violin and composing music very difficult. Apparently, a few people still play Beethoven's music today. Jackie Chan paused. Every eye in the room was locked on him. He continued, I'm grateful these people didn't give up, and I hope you don't give up either, because your failures, shortcomings, and challenges can either end up as your excuse or your story. I hope you choose courage, curiosity, and persistence, because those are stories worth telling. Having watched all of Jackie's films with his father and Jordan growing up, John was a huge fan, but it wasn't his movies that John was still thinking about that night as he lay in bed. Instead, it was the incredible stories Jackie told. John never realized that so many of the people he admired had gone through such adversity throughout their lives. He finally drifted off to sleep. He knew that if all of them could overcome such incredible challenges, then so could he. Chapter 26. One day, as the sun was about to go down, Akira found John at the shooting range. He was still firing intensely focused. Thwack! 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 He sent arrow after arrow into the target, hurriedly reloading and moving on to the next. Akira calmly asked, John, what are you shooting for? I need to get 4 bullseye groupings in a row before I lose the light. Why? Without thinking, John snapped, because that's Katsu's record and I need to beat him. Be honest, do you really need that? John shook his head, slowly deflating as Akira continued. Let me tell you a story about trying to reach a goal before losing the light. A very long time ago, I was in love with a girl named Kimiko. One summer, I surprised her with a trip to a land she had always wanted to visit, Croatia, home of some of the most beautiful waterfalls in the world. There was one waterfall in particular whose beauty captured us. We found out about it on the last day of our journey, and I was determined to see it before we left the country. Our guides at the hotel had told us that this beautiful place was 5 hours away, through the winding mountain roads and over several dangerous bridges. So we awoke at dawn and began our journey. After driving trucks for a living, I was confident I could navigate the difficult roads and terrain in plenty of time to get there. According to my calculations, we would arrive at the waterfall halfway through the afternoon at the latest. I drove us through the winding mountain roads like a madman, but all of my driving crazy was for nothing when we arrived at our first sign of trouble. The first bridge wasn't a bridge at all, but a car ferry across a wide lake, and the next ferry didn't leave for another hour and a half. We took some pictures by the beautiful ferry and tried to enjoy the view and the journey. Truthfully, though, I was not enjoying any of it because my sole focus was on achieving my goal to get to the waterfall, and I wouldn't be satisfied until I made it there. Determined to make up our lost time, we were the first people off the ferry. We stopped at the toll booth on the mountain road where the operator informed us, despite my calculations, that the waterfall was an hour away, it was more like 2 hours away with the muddy roads. As we drove, Kimiko asked me, "Do you want to do something else? I just want to spend time with you. It doesn't matter what we do." I shrugged her off as if she just suggested we ride a wooden horse instead of experience something truly spectacular. I were going to make it to the cascading waterfall. I began to snap at Kimiko, irritated at even the slightest inconvenience. I wish I could say I was enjoying the journey, but I wasn't. Instead, I was angrily focused on how quickly I could make each turn in the road. Instead of enjoying the beautiful vistas around us, I could not get my mind off my goal. And with the sun passing overhead, I knew we did not have much time. We finally arrived at the trailhead to the waterfall, but as we got out of the car, we saw that even the man and woman running a roadside stand nearby were beginning to pack up for the day. I asked them frantically, "How do we get to the waterfall? It's too late. How do I get to the waterfall? It's too late. Come back tomorrow. We leave in the morning, and now is the only time. How do I get to the waterfall?" The waterfall is several miles away. It's about to downpour, and the trail is not easy. It is a very bad idea. You can't make it there and back. There isn't enough light. It is very dangerous. You will be in the middle of the forest with no one around to help you if you get in trouble. But I refused to listen to them. Instead, I pulled Kimiko with me, ignoring the ominous clouds that gathered overhead and the rapidly fading daylight. I had now traveled for over 8 hours to experience this beautiful cascading waterfall, and it was too late to turn back or admit defeat. Even Kimiko's patience was beginning to wear thin as we trekked through the mountains, and I'm sure she asked if we could just stop and go somewhere else multiple times along the muddy trail, but she might as well have asked a statue because I just kept going. As we crossed the first bridge, it started to rain. I stopped to get a photo of her running across the bridge, and then I ran on. It was muddy and hard to get good footing after the bridge, but we kept going. Occasionally, I looked back to see if I could still see her. We passed two other travelers on their way back down the mountain. I asked, "Is it worth it?" And they replied, "Oh, it's amazing, but you'll never make it in time." I told Kimiko to go back with them, and I pressed on. I took off running. It started to rain, but I ran harder. I came across a pond in the middle of the path, and I could barely get around it. The light was getting worse. I kept running hard. Although the hills were making my legs burn, I got to the top of another one, and reality finally set in. I could make it to the cascading waterfall, but then I would have no light for a difficult, even with sunlight, trek back. I was in the middle of a foreign country. There were wild animals in this forest. Kimiko was worried sick, and I had abandoned her. It was pouring rain. I had not eaten all day. The rainstorm was killing the last of the sunlight. I was not going to reach my goal. I would not experience the cascading waterfall. I screamed at the top of my lungs. I cursed the rain in Croatia. I sacrificed so much to achieve my goal, and I was so close. But I knew I needed to turn back. I screamed, and I cursed it all again, and I finally turned around. John, this is where I learned the truth about partially controllable goals. They are very alluring, but very dangerous. Things like winning, rebounding, sales, or beating your opponent's records can distract you from what is more important, the person we become on the journey. That day, my focus was on the partially controllable goal, and I spoiled the journey, my character, my health, and my relationship in the process. I compromised the things that are not only important to me, but the things I spend my life trying to teach others to do well. Cascading waterfalls in life are sexy and alluring, and I hope you get to experience some of them. But if we focus on them instead of true mental toughness, we so often end up compromising all the things that truly matter. Sometimes we make it to the waterfalls, many times we do not. But regardless of whether we achieve our goal or not, There is always a path of destruction in our wake. True mental toughness is having a great attitude, giving your very, very best, treating people really, really well, having unconditional gratitude, regardless of your circumstances. It might be easier to justify that wake of destruction when you achieve the goal, but it's even more of a reality check when you do not. John, a wise man once said, "You can go chase a dream, but then sometimes you look back and there's a trail of tears behind you, and the tears are usually your wife and kids." I have no wife and children, but that day I learned the truth, that focusing on partially controllable goals can be much more trouble than it's worth. John nodded, looking up as the night sky faded down around them. The light was now gone for shooting, but he felt relieved and his body felt lighter. "Thank you, Akira Sensei. I think I needed to hear that today. I can really get derailed sometimes when I get so focused on what I want." Akira nodded. "I know, John. I still have to relearn this lesson too sometimes." John grinned. "So maybe one day we'll both learn." Akira just smiled back. "Yes, John. Let's hope so." Chapter 27. One day during lunch, the apprentices gathered in the dining hall as usual. But in the midst of some good-natured joking, Katsu crossed a line, talking about how John had choked in the last tournament. John didn't hear a single word after that. His blood boiled, and before he knew it, he had tackled Katsu. They rolled wildly across the floor, food flying, each trying to land a punch. As the other apprentices pulled them apart, John made one last lunge, but Katsu dodged, sending John slipping past him on the slick floor, then crashing to the ground. As he fell, John heard a hollow pop, followed by a wrenching bolt of pain as his arm shattered into two pieces. Later that day, after the doctors had finished setting his arm and had sent him back from the hospital, John was sitting in his room when Akira arrived. John looked away, unable to meet his sensei's eyes. He felt ashamed. He wasn't ready for a lecture. But instead of a lecture, the old man seemed to be filled with joy. "John, it's great to see you. I know you wish the circumstances were different, and believe me, I know how you feel. I was a hothead growing up as well, and I got in plenty of trouble. It took me a long time to learn how to live by principles instead of feelings. Many years ago, I even found myself in a place just like the one you're in right now. I'd been knocked out, my face was split open, and my nose was broken by a man much larger than myself. But I chose to believe it was in my best interest and an opportunity to learn and grow. That mindset helped propel me towards becoming the man I am today." "Wait a second," said John. "You can't just say something like that and skip over it." Akira just smiled. "That is a story for another day. Right now, we have more important things to think about. Did you know that the Chinese symbol for danger and opportunity are the same?" John shook his head as Akira continued. "At every crossroads, there are at least two choices: to view your circumstances as a calamity or to view it as an incredible opportunity. The most important question to think about right now is this. 5 years from today, will you be ashamed of how you shrank from what you saw as a calamity, or will you look back and be proud of how you maximized your incredible opportunity?" John nodded, but couldn't stop the tears that began to sting his eyes. "I just can't believe I was this stupid. Why did I have to break my arm? I'm trying to believe that this is in my best interest and an opportunity to learn and grow, but it seems impossible to believe right now." His sensei pulled up a chair beside his bed. "I figured you'd feel like that. So I thought maybe we could talk about chasing lions on snowy days." John couldn't help but chuckle through the tears. "I don't know how that's going to help, but let's hear it." Akira continued. "The thing about incredible opportunities is that they often come to us disguised as 500-pound lions. Right now, you are face-to-face with one of the many lions you encounter in life. The question is, what will you believe about it? And what will you do about it? There is an ancient story about a warrior named Benaiya, and while he doesn't get very many lines in the book, they tell us a lot about life. In the first line, it says that one day he chased a lion into a pit on a snowy day, and he killed it. The next line says that Benaiya went on to become King David's chief bodyguard. When most people come face to face with their opportunities, lions, they run as fast as they can in the opposite direction. But when you decide to embrace the lion and chase it, you have the opportunity to build your resume, your character, and your skills. John, No one is interested in watching a story where the hero doesn't have to overcome a lot of adversity. That would be incredibly boring. We were born to chase lions and climb the mountains in our life. Do I condone you getting into a fight? Not at all. But we all have different challenges in life, and now you have found yourself here. I would never want someone to come face to face with a lion on a snowy day. But I can tell you one thing. If I were the king, I would want the guy who had the courage to chase and kill the lion to be my bodyguard. Right now, you have an opportunity to develop mental, emotional, and relational skills in a way that you would never have had you not suffered this physical setback. But what you do with that opportunity is up to you. Will you squander it wasting time, or will you harness the opportunity and allow it to build you into more of the person you want to become? John grinned, sounding more like his old self. I want to harness the opportunity. Good. He walked to a cabinet and pulled out a pen and notepad. I want you to make a can-do list of all the things you can do to get better while you are not able to train. I would start with reading at least 15 books off the Train to Be Clutch reading challenge. John nodded, then started thinking about all the things he could do to get better while he was injured. He started writing. Visualization exercises. Listening to guided imagery. Doing highlight film study of his best shots. Film study of other great samurai archers. Encouraging teammates. Writing articles about the lessons learned during the time. Strength training areas not affected by the injury. Hand-eye coordination exercises with the other arm. Studying wisdom. As he finished, Akira looked over the list and then nodded in approval. Those are a few great examples, and I'm certain you can think of many more over the next couple of days. Now I've got to get back out to the range, but it sounds like you have a list of can-do things to start working on. I sure do, said John, and thank you for helping me see this as an opportunity. I'll do my best to take it on, just like a lion on a snowy day. Chapter 28. A few days later, John returned from his check-in at the hospital with his arm in a cast and a recommendation from the doctors of 4 weeks of no strenuous physical activity, followed by 8 weeks of only light physical activity. As he grabbed his lunch in the dining hall, Akira came up alongside him with a to-go carton. How about we go for a walk? John was happy to comply as they took their lunch to a massive tree on the property. Under its shade, they ate in silence for a while. Then Akira asked, John, do you remember me talking to you a few days ago about how it took me a long time to learn to live by principles, not feelings? John nodded, quietly acknowledging that he had. Akira went on, like I said, just like you, I was quite a hothead when I was younger. I made many stupid and careless choices that caused others and myself much pain. Thankfully, I had a mentor in my life who brought me out of that and taught me about living by principles. When I was about your age, he had seen me react to several different situations. Finally, he asked me a very simple question. How is your strategy of living by your feelings working out for you? I got very quiet and I had to admit it wasn't working out very well at all. He then shared a quote from a man named Eric Thomas. At the end of your feelings is nothing, but at the end of every principle is a promise. Living by feelings is never going to work out well for anyone because feelings change. Sometimes we simply wake up and we feel differently. Sometimes someone does something to make us feel differently. Living by our feelings is like riding an emotional roller coaster. When you make the choice to live by a certain set of principles, it will not only protect you from your feelings, it will allow you to step into your greatest potential. Many days you aren't going to feel like working out and honing your craft. Many days you aren't going to feel like treating people really well. Many days you aren't going to feel like being unconditionally grateful. Many days you aren't going to feel like giving your very, very best. But the principle says you are going to reap what you sow. The principle says that diligent workers are going to serve kings instead of ordinary men. The principle says to turn the other cheek. The principle says to seek wise counsel. The principle says to speak life and not death. At the end of principles, there is life, freedom, hope, joy, and peace. The most you can expect from feelings is happiness. But like every other feeling, happiness doesn't last. That's exactly why trillion-dollar industries try to keep you chasing it, because it is perpetually unavailable. If you want to stay on the happiness train, you must keep coming back to make more and more purchases, trying to get another hit of that feeling, a new pair of sneakers, a new car, a new iPhone, It's a never-ending pit of desire. And if you spend your whole life chasing that feeling, you'll miss out on what we really want, fulfillment. Where happiness is easy and me-focused, fulfillment is hard and others-focused. Where happiness comes from a life lived in endless pursuit of feelings, fulfillment comes from a life lived in faithful commitment to principles. It is healthy to acknowledge our feelings, but when it comes to action, we are much better served to act on our principles rather than feelings. John, what I want you to do is to seek out principles from ancient wisdom that have been tried and tested through the ages. When you switch from living by your feelings to living by your principles, you will start to see very different fruit in your life. It's not easy, and sometimes you'll slip up and make choices based off your feelings. Pick yourself up and get back on the road to living by your principles rather than your feelings. It's not easy, but, he nodded to John's cast, it's a lot better than living by your feelings. John laughed in agreement as Akira went on. Now, can you think of at least 4 principles you've learned so far from your time here that you want to live by? John started to think deeply. He finally replied, 1, you are building your own house. 2, to play present, you must train to live present. 3, you must surrender the outcome and commit to the process, or you will become your own worst enemy. And 4, no matter what my circumstances are, chop wood, carry water. Akira smiled. My ninja, those are excellent. I'm happy to see our time together is paying off. Now, each day when you wake up, before you enter the shooting range or before you compete, write out 4 to 6 principles that you want to stick to no matter what. Stick them in your pocket, and if you feel yourself wanting to live by your feelings, either touch that pocket or pull them out and say them aloud a few times by yourself. Got it? Yes, Akira-sensei, said John. He was excited to use this new tool. Chapter 29. A few months and many reps of the can-do list later, John was finally cleared to train fully again. The night before, he was so excited he could barely sleep. The next morning, Akira joined him as they walked to the range together. I'm so excited for you to be back out here shooting, John. I'm sure you are too. You've got that right, John nodded, bouncing on his feet as he walked. Akira smiled. Just remember, excitement is very powerful. It can help you or hurt you. It all depends on how you use it. What do you mean, Akira? Well, there are 2 concepts I think it's important for me to share with you that I'm not sure you're even aware of. The first is labeling. How you label your internal feelings makes a massive difference in how you filter their meaning. If you get butterflies in your stomach and your hands start to sweat, you could label that as being nervous and underprepared, or you could label it as being excited and prepared. But rest assured, how you label it is going to directly impact the meaning you give those feelings. A wise man once told me, the words we use to label our experiences are a filter to meaning. The most important thing is rarely what we experience or feel, but rather the meaning we give that experience or feeling. We can give them beneficial and constructive labels and meaning, or we can give them destructive and unhelpful labels. Which one we give is up to us. We rarely have full control over the things that happen to us in life, but we do have the power to determine what those events and feelings mean to us. I'd never thought about that before, John nodded. What's the second concept? It's called the warrior dial. Think about your warrior dial as being from 1 to 10. 1 is ultra stealth mode and barely moving. 10 is a super hyped kamikaze screaming and running into a building with a bomb strapped to them. Every one of us can turn our warrior dial up or down, and depending on the context of the situation and when we are at our best, we'd be wise to do so. Think about today. Based off the context of the day and it being your first day back, where do you think you're at on the warrior dial? John thought for a second, then he answered, I'm probably at an 8 or a 9. Akira nodded his head in agreement. And where do you think you need to be at your best and not get re-injured? John replied, honestly, I'm not sure. Growing up, I was always taught that you were supposed to get hyped before games, watching movies like Braveheart and listening to upbeat music. I've never really thought about this before. Then I'm glad we're talking about it now, said Akira. I think the best samurai archers would tell you that your best shooting will happen around a 4 or a 5. If your dial is too high, you are more likely to miss your targets. John nodded. trying to process what he had heard while simultaneously wondering why he'd never learned about this growing up playing sports. So how do you turn your warrior dial down? His sensei smiled wide. I was hoping you would ask. You can turn your warrior dial down by doing deep breathing exercises, talking slower, lowering your voice, listening to classical music, and slowing your movements. In fact, many of your teams in the West would benefit from turning their dial down before the quote-unquote big games and turning it up before the quote-unquote smaller games. You already know how to turn your warrior dial up by watching inspirational movies, listening to upbeat music, and by jumping around. But in my experience, it is more challenging to turn your dial down. It will take practice, but you'll get the hang of it. John grinned. Thank you, Sensei. I'm excited to try it out today. Sure enough, as soon as John gripped his bow, a surge of energy flowed through him. Remembering Akira's lesson, though, he breathed deeply, hummed a slow song, calming his mind and letting oxygen in his lungs quiet his nerves. That simple exercise was enough to steady his hand as he knocked an arrow, drew, and released, sending the arrow slamming into the bullseye. It felt good that all of his mental training was paying off, but it felt even better just to get back out on the blocks and be able to chop wood and carry water again. It seemed as if John was finally learning to fall in love with the process of becoming great. Chapter 30. As the years passed, John kept training with focus and perseverance. In cold weather and warm, he kept chopping wood and carrying water. In wind and rain, and sun and storms, he kept beating on his craft, focusing on mental training when the weather was too rough to shoot, and shooting for 4 hours each day, every day. And before he knew it, John had nearly spent 10 years at the samurai community. He was very close now to graduation. One day at dusk, just as the sun was setting, John was finishing up his shooting when Akira approached, watching his apprentice with great pride. As John finished his shooting, he and Akira walked back to the dining hall. As they did, Akira said, John, you are very close to finishing your training now. You will graduate as a samurai archer soon, and then you will dive back into the world. Before you do, there is something I must share with you. And what is that, Akira-sensei? I want you to know that when you get back into the world, you will face a unique challenge. You will face the challenge of they. John just blinked curious. Who are they? John, we come out of the womb creating and exploring. But then we start school, and we are told to sit down, shut up, and get in line. We are told to behave and to color inside the lines. We are told to dream sensibly and to be realistic. You want to know who they are? They are the ones that say all of that. And if you don't obey, if you don't do what they say, they call you disobedient, unassimilated, disturbed, or they diagnose you with ADHD. Then they drug you, all to get you to fit into their nice little box. They called a coach named John Wooden crazy when he tried to run a press for the entire game. They also thought it was crazy he didn't scout opponents. Rather, he chose to focus on letting the other team worry about stopping his. The board at Apple ran Steve Jobs out of the company, calling him crazy and reckless. 12 years later, months away from bankruptcy, they came crawling back, begging him to come back and save them. He took Apple from the fringes of bankruptcy to one of the most successful and innovative companies of all time. They wanted to have the man committed who came up with the idea of television. They thought the idea of a 24-hour sports network was stupid and could never work. They called Nelson Mandela a terrorist, and they called Jackie Robinson much worse. Rest assured, they will call you all sorts of names. They will throw down the gauntlet in front of you. They will do everything they can to keep you inside their safe container. If you put one crab in a bucket, it will crawl out. If you put multiple crabs in a bucket, they will pull each other down every time one starts to crawl out. If a crab continues to try and crawl out of the bucket, the other crabs will break its leg. Unfortunately, John, we live in a society of crabs. But we weren't created to sit still and learn the right answer. We were created to explore, create, to learn, and to love. Be courageous and never listen to they. Once you break out, they will call you a genius and tell everyone how talented you are. They will try and neatly sweep all your years of sweat, turmoil, and uncommon persistence under the rug. Why? Because it is so much more comfortable to believe that talent is reserved for the chosen few than it is to work your ever-loving butt off to become the best you are capable
of being. And most importantly, please don't try and teach your friends and family the lessons you learned here. But that doesn't make any sense, said John. John, you must understand the importance of context. There will be people who ask you for wisdom, but you must never cross boundaries without an invitation. A wise man once said, the difference between a pest and a guest is an invitation. You have gained so much wisdom while you are here, but most people aren't interested in learning or changing. It's very sad, but you need to be prepared for what you are walking into. If I were the best heart surgeon in the world and my best friend had a heart problem that only I could fix, does that give me permission to do surgery on him? John was puzzled, but eventually said, I guess not. Exactly. I would still need permission to perform heart surgery. Even though you are equipped with life-changing wisdom that could transform lives, you must not share it without an invitation. Most people just want to be heard and loved. They don't want your wisdom, and that's okay. Sometimes you can actually become the greatest impediment to other people growing when you try and force things on them. In time, if they see you model it, they will probably start to ask. I've never seen this ancient wisdom fail to come true. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. But I'll share something with you I've never shared with you before. I don't ask your permission to share wisdom with you because of the nature and context of our relationship. However, with my friends and family, I always ask, would you like my opinion? Or do you just need to be heard and want me to listen? Sometimes this annoys them, and just because I could help, I must make sure that they need it, want it, and give me their permission. Trust me, John, disregard this advice at your own peril. We get letters from former apprentices all the time, and this is their biggest challenge they face when they reassimilate back into the real world. Thank you, Akira Sensei. I will do my best to always be a guest and never a pest. Chapter 31. One night after John had finished his chores at the shooting range, he was walking back to the dining hall when Akira found him, waving him down. John, could you come over here, please? I have a gift for you. John walked over to him, curious. As he approached, Akira handed him a small gift box wrapped in rice paper and string. I've been meaning to give you this for a while now. It's something very valuable that I very much want you to have before you leave this place. Excited, John untied the string and, smiling wide, opened the box. Suddenly, his smile wavered as he saw what was inside, a simple gray stone. Totally unremarkable. It's a stone? Yes, but not just any stone. That stone is from the top of Mount Fuji, the first mountain I ever climbed. I want you to have it as a reminder to always climb the mountains in your own life. Climbing mountains is difficult, costly, and dangerous. And if offered the choice between difficult, costly, and dangerous, or safe, cheap, and comfortable, most people will choose the second option. But if you want to become great, if you want to become the man that you're destined to become, you must consistently be willing to do what others will not. Meraki is a Greek word that means doing something with passion and soul. How many people do you see engaged in Meraki at work, school, or in sports? The majority of people are disengaged and just going through the motions. They have given away their power and believe their development and opportunities are up to everyone else. That is a lie. It is up to you. But you're going to have to go against the grain. And a lot of people are going to be angry. They're going to want you to sit down, shut up, and do what you're told. But if you want to be great, you must be willing to boldly step away from the crowd and take personal responsibility for your own journey and development. Like this. Akira leaned down to the ground and used a stick to sketch the following picture. Two circles. One of the circles had three dots spread out. The other circle was completely full of dots. Look at these two circles. Imagine that the dots in each of these circles represent people. How replaceable are any of the people in the left circle? Virtually impossible, right? There's only three. Now, how about the circle on the right? How replaceable are each of those? Highly replaceable, right? If you're learning and doing what tens of thousands of other people are learning and doing, then even if you are the very best, you are still highly replaceable. But when you go on a self-directed journey, you're learning things and developing skills that make you highly irreplaceable. Even if you aren't the best, it's still very hard to replace you.
Mediocrity is replaceable. Greatness is not. Most people will never do what greatness requires. Most people will never climb their mountains. But John, we only get one lifetime. And maybe I'm crazy, but I believe the pain of regret lasts much longer than the pain of injury. I'm not promised tomorrow, and I want my life today to reflect that in the way that I live. I wish more people lived that way. I wish more people would just stop pretending that they get to live twice. John, the point of life is not to arrive safely at death. Don't believe that lie. On your deathbed, you will regret the mountains you chose not to climb. You won't regret the bumps, bruises, broken bones, and scars you got from the ones you did. Of course, there will always be valid, legitimate, responsible excuses not to climb mountains. But you must choose to climb them anyway. Mountains were meant to be climbed. Sure, it will inevitably take longer and require more effort than you ever realized at the outset, but it will also be infinitely more worthwhile. Not because of what you will achieve, but because of who you will become through the process. When given the option to stay comfortable where you are or risk the cold, injury, and more, most people choose comfortable. But I hope that instead you choose to do what others won't, and eventually you'll be able to do what others can't. I hope that at every opportunity you get, John, you choose to climb the mountains and chase the lions in your life. Chapter 32. During his last weeks in the community, John tried his best to soak everything in, knowing that he would be leaving soon. One Sunday afternoon, he and Akira went for a hike along one of their favorite routes up into the surrounding hills. They had done this hike many times, but took it extra slow this one. They wanted to soak up every second. As they rested at the top of the hill, John looked out over the view, shaking his head in amazement. "It's so different from when I first arrived. Those trees weren't even as high as my shoulders," he pointed to a soaring cluster of maples. "And the big oak that blocked our view for the first few years, it's gone now. We can see a whole new ridge." Akira nodded. "Indeed, much has changed. And you've only been here for 10 years. Imagine how I feel." They laughed as Akira continued. "It reminds me of a truth you'll soon find useful as you move on from here. You'll enter a world where society, education systems, media, marketing departments, big business, parents, friends, they will do their best to give you a map by which to live your life. This map points out how things are done, what the rules are, and where the boundaries exist. But the problem is the world has changed, and that map is not the territory anymore. It's an outdated and somewhat useless map." "Really? How so?" Akira paused for a second, lost in thought. Then he looked into John's eyes, intently. "Let me tell you a parable. A long time ago, all the farms in the world were owned by a few very powerful people. Only the elites, or the knighted, talented ones, were able to rent the land and the tools and were allowed to reap the profits, while the rest of the world worked the land for generations, believing that they didn't have the talent, the money, or the relationships to farm on their own. Thus, they believed they were entirely dependent on the elites who owned the farms. So all day they worked fields they didn't own, and every night the elites gave them addictive things to numb their pain, from squashing their passion and not pursuing what set their souls on fire. The elites shamed anyone who stepped out and tried to do something on their own, ruthlessly maintaining their system that ensured the status quo. But over time, everything started to change. The tools that used to cost tens of thousands of dollars began to improve until they were available for free or pennies on the dollar. The land that once rented out for millions of dollars eventually became available for free. When a small band of brave workers figured this out, they ran to tell all their friends who had jobs at farms or were standing in line to get them. They thought everyone would be grateful to hear the good news, but instead, no one believed them. They told them they were crazy and chased them away with pitchforks. Only a few people who were brave enough, desperate enough, or had been rejected enough times followed them back. And while these few brave workers still struggled to understand the rejection of their friends, they decided to just put their heads down and do the work anyway. The first couple of years on their own were incredibly hard, sometimes so hard that they wondered if they'd made a terrible mistake. Life with their friends back on the farms with the illusion of safety and security started to look like a good idea. Sure, they hated the work and didn't own the farms, but at least they had some company and a steady, if not very small, paycheck. But they kept working faithfully, and slowly they began to make breakthroughs. The breakthroughs became bigger and more frequent until finally, after 5 years of working the land on their own, they started to really reap the benefits. They now had more time, resources, and satisfaction from doing the things they loved on their own schedule. They even reaped enough to start multiplying their farms and starting new ones. After 10 long years, they had become so successful and independent, their old friends, still stuck working on the farms they didn't own, barely recognized them. They couldn't figure out how these brave workers who they'd known all their lives and grown up with could have possibly transformed like this. But when the brave workers told them how they simply put in the work and reminded them that the farmland and tools were sitting right there, available for anyone to use, they couldn't believe it. So instead, they just called these brave farmers talented or chosen, writing off all their hard work. I don't quite know if I follow the parable, Akira Sensei. What it means, John, is that the world has dramatically shifted, and the gatekeepers who used to decide who got power and opportunity have lost the majority of that power. Attention and trust are the two most valuable resources in the world, and for a long time, only the people who had real estate on Main Street, an ad on one of the few TV channels, or a voice in one of the few newspapers could control those resources. But today, with tools like websites, blogs, online stores, YouTube, Instagram, and self-publishing, attention and trust can be built by anyone willing to put in the work. Things that used to be virtually impossible to build and create on your own can now be done with just a click. But still, very few people have woken up to that truth, because doing so requires getting uncomfortable and breaking away from much of what they've known their whole lives. They would rather have the perceived illusion of safety with a consistent job, even if it's one where they are completely disengaged doing things they don't believe in, all while complaining about how unfairly they're being treated, despite being able to quit at any time. They have been so brainwashed by a system that encourages disengagement, passing tests, and buying stuff you don't need to impress people you don't like that they can't see the reality, that there are fields all around them just waiting to be farmed. Today, you don't need to work on someone else's farm. Instead, you can farm the whole world doing the things you're incredibly passionate about. All it costs is your full engagement and the sweat equity of doing tremendously hard work for years in a row with very little return on your investment. It requires going out on your own and studying the territory from those who are successfully navigating the new world we live in. It requires persistently and consistently experimenting with the strategies and wisdom you learn from them. Yes, it will take longer than the instant gratification of a normal job that will give you table scraps at best, but eventually the harvest can be yours. But very few understand this, because they've been studying old maps their whole lives, instead of waking up and exploring the rapidly changing territory on their own. John was amazed. Wow, I guess I never thought of it like that. John, this is why it's so important to understand that the map is not the territory. Akira gestured to the beautiful vista in front of them. Just like this view has changed, so has the world. But most people would rather trust their old, outdated map than do the hard work of exploring the territory on their own and finding out what it really is and what is actually possible. John, one large research study found that 74% of people will knowingly give the wrong answer just to not stand out and be ostracized by the group. This is why most people wander around cluelessly, stumbling into roadblocks and ending up at the wrong destinations, wondering why no one told them that the territory is entirely different from the maps they'd been told to study. You have been lied to and misled and told that if you ace the test on the map, you will be prepared for the territory. But who would you rather have as a guide? The person who studied an old map for 25 years, or the person who has studied and survived in the territory for 25 years? The map is easy. Anyone can read a map. Navigating the territory is the hard part. I'd rather have somebody who's navigated the territory of the new world for 5 years than somebody who's spent a lifetime studying old maps. Now, I've done my best to equip you with a toolbox to help you as you navigate the territory alone and map it for yourself. A compass, an internal one, built on the principles and timeless wisdom of chop wood, carry water. You've learned the value of beating on your craft, being bold and courageous, always asking, who says? and you have truly fallen in love with the process of becoming great. As you go out into the world, you will need these tools more than ever to find your way. I don't know how I could have ever done it without you, Akira. I'm internally grateful. He grabbed his wise old teacher and gave him a big bear hug. Chapter 33. By the time he neared graduation, John had become one of the most accurate archers in his class. He was able to pack the bullseye with a cluster of three arrows, even at a far range. Finally, after 10 years of training, John had become a samurai archer. After his graduation ceremony, and before he left the community to travel back home, John and Akira took one last long walk through the grounds. They passed many of their favorite locations, spots that John had come to love during his time there. As they walked, Akira told him how proud he was, saying, "You know now that excellence is within your reach, John. It is accomplished through deliberate actions, ordinary in themselves, performed consistently and carefully, made into habits, compounded together, and added up over time. I learned this from a coach in your country who has won 22 national championships. He said that greatness is a bunch of small things done well, added up over time, that most people think are too small to matter. As a matter of fact, I have one final story for you to demonstrate the power of being deliberate and consistent with the small things." John let out a giant belly laugh. "Of course you do." "I can't help it," laughed Akira. In 2004, 9 Michigan hospitals decided to experiment with a new procedure, and in just a few months, it had reduced the infection rates by 66%. By a year and a half, over 1,500 lives and $75 million had been saved. "Wow, that's incredible. Was it a new innovative technology or drug?" asked John. "Nope. It was a simple checklist of 5 items. You could say it was their chop wood, carry water list. The item at the top of the checklist was wash your hands." "No way. We figured out that washing your hands could prevent disease and save lives in the middle of the 1800s. John practically yelled at Akira. "Exactly, John. Society will always push us towards what is new and innovative and the next big thing. But immense power and potential is harnessed through focusing on doing the simple and small things with incredible consistency and discipline. Don't fall for the traps and counterfeits. Never forget what you have learned here. Focus on the process. Trust the process." Tears and emotions started to flood over John as he barely got out. "I'm going to miss all those stories, and I'm not sure how I'm going to do life without you, Akira." "John, you have learned to fall in love with the process of becoming great, to take the rough side of the mountain, and to let your skills and character be refined by the day-in, day-out process of chopping wood and carrying water. I'm so proud of you. You will flourish in the world. You have been trained well." John couldn't stop smiling as his sensei's words resonated inside of him. This was one of the most fulfilling days of his life, not because of what he had achieved, but because of the man he had become in the process. Akira wrapped him in a big hug, then said, "Before you leave, there is one more thing we must do. I want you to close your eyes, put your hand on your heart, and take some deep breaths. I want you to think about all the names you have gone by in your life. Each one of those names probably represents a part of your personality. And I want you to think, which of the names represents the strongest, kindest, and most authentic version of you?" John obeyed, closing his eyes and taking a deep breath. Finally, he opened them and he said with resolution, "Jonathan does. Growing up, my family always called me Johnny. That's the very playful side of my personality, but also a very immature version of myself. Eventually, people started calling me John, but that side of my personality is kind of a soft pushover. I think that Jonathan is the best, most authentic version of me." Akira smiled and said, "Then from now on, tell people that your name is Jonathan and do not allow them to call you anything else. Names are very powerful. In the Bible, many people experienced name changes, and those name changes were very pivotal moments in their lives. You have transformed through your time here, Jonathan, and you need to have a new name that represents that transformation. I am excited for all the journeys you will go on from here, and I trust that you will impact many people's lives in the process. I'm so grateful and honored to have known you." Jonathan nodded his heart filled with so many emotions, he embraced Akira one last time. Eventually, he let go, grabbing his bags to leave. "Akira sensei, I'll never forget my time here. Thank you for teaching me how to chop wood, carry water, and to fall in love with the process of becoming great." "My blessing, Jonathan," said Akira with a big smile and a few tears. "You are more powerful than you'll ever realize. Act accordingly." So I hope that this story encouraged and inspired you. And the last thing that I want to leave you with is this. Stop pretending you get to live twice. Stop getting by with average. Stop settling for easy. Stop settling for counterfeits. Stop living someone else's life. And stop chasing other people's version of success. Start pursuing excellence. Start beating on your craft. Start doing what you were created for. Start becoming relentless in the pursuit of what sets your soul on fire. I can't wait to hear about how this story has impacted your life. Are you ready to apply everything you learned? Email me at joshua@train2bclutch.com. And in the subject line, put, "I want the chop wood, carry water action plan," to get your free action plan today with discussion questions and more ways to incorporate the chop wood, carry water principles into your life and culture. We have all sorts of really cool resources, from keynote speaking, our mentorship program, the Train to Be Clutch Reading Challenge, our transformational leadership retreats, online video courses, and then you can also just join the Train to Be Clutch community and get tons of free resources every single week. All of that is available at t2bc.com. Letter T, number 2, B as in boy, C as in car.com. t2bc.com. We've also written some other books: Burn Your Goals, Transformational Leadership, Hustle, The Principal Circle, and The War at Work. You can find me on Twitter at Joshua Medcalf, on Instagram at Real Joshua Medcalf. Thank you guys, and hope you have a great week. Chop Wood, Carry Water: How to Fall in Love with the Process of Becoming Great, by Joshua Medcalf. Read by Joshua Medcalf. Copyright 2016, Joshua Medcalf. Production copyright 2016, Joshua Medcalf.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.